FM WRAF HD1 Detroit.
Now,
this is Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the riff at 4WRIF. That's 4-9-7-4-3. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome. We're all set to do another show. Hey, we're bankrupt.
We are officially.
And I don't mean Julene and I. I don't mean WRIF, but the city of Detroit. And that we is kind of an interesting formulation because I suspect, Julene, tell me if you think I'm correct. I'll bet you 90% of our listening audience does not live in the city of Detroit proper.
We have a lot of loyal
listeners in Detroit.
Yes,
of course,
we do.
They call. We always welcome you at 248-544-WRIF.
That is 248-544-9743.
But we live in that metropolitan area, and you know, lately, when I go downtown, it looks like just, we've talked about this before, this sparkling, wonderful city. Friday last night was Noel night, and
yes.
a friend of mine said, gee, it was like New York. I mean, huge throngs of crowds.
Yeah,
and
that always
huge
does.
Throngs of crowds. That's a weird formulation.
Huge throngs.
Huge throngs or huge crowds. Said sidewalk 4 deep, just music everywhere. And then we went over, my wife and I went over to the east side. Us west siders don't rarely get over there.
I feel like we're central, more centrally located.
You
where
mean
where
we live?
We live, yeah.
No. Well, just because you're from Des Moines.
Oh, stop it.
Yeah. Definitely west side. So, but we went over to the Cadieux Cafe, which is a Belgian cafe, and it has what they call feather bowling.
Did you do some feather bowling?
No, I never have, actually.
I have.
Have you?
Well, see there, Mr. Detroit.
Yeah. At the Cadieux Cafe.
And the Free Press, it says you're not a Michigander until you've... You need to do some
Well, I've actually
bowling.
Rolled a couple of those discs, but
it's
never played the game.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, here's the deal, folks. People are saying, wait a minute, how do you roll
a feather?
Yeah. And what is he, just kind of place a feather, then it's sort of like shuffleboard? You want to roll these discs down this alleyway?
It's some kind of ancient form of...
I was more interested in the Belgian beer.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give them a shout out as a chef. They have good food there. Don't they have mussels?
Mussels, yeah. And folks, those are those little shell, those things that look like clams, not, the mussel of
I haven't had a mussel since I'm so transparent on this show, but I got drunk with the lead singer of Buck Cherry.
Oh, yeah?
And I drank White Russians and ate mussels.
Oh.
Then proceeded to get drunk and dirty dance with the lead singer of Buck Cherry. And then I went home
TMI.
And listen, and I hurled my brains out.
Oh, man.
So I haven't had a muscle since.
But I'm cutting her.
If I'm going to do it.
Cut her mic off. Cut her mic off.
That's a great story. Come
it
on.
Is.
Who else
it
can
is.
Say that?
But people, probably any number of people that heard from their friends, you know, there's this absolutely terrific political talk show on WRIF at 11 o'clock.
That girl. Hey, that was a long time. That was in my wild days.
Yeah. What was that? 2 weeks ago.
All right.
But hey, let's get back. Well,
bankrupt.
I started it. Yeah,
bankrupt.
Yeah.
And
Belgian
Noel
beer.
Knight
and I want to give a shout out.
Ooh,
ooh.
That was interesting.
Yeah, a shout out to one of my favorite bands, Detroit local bands, the Luddites.
Oh, were they playing last night?
They were. They play all acoustic instruments, but they're amplified, of course. And it's a 10-piece band. And
so no one gets paid. They don't care. They don't do it for the money.
Yeah, well, can you imagine that? It's like $5 at the door to get in. And someone said, what kind of music do they play? And I don't even know how to really
They're extremely
call.
Eclectic.
Yeah, it's like kind of a cross between rock and roll and Eastern European.
A little gypsy-ish.
Yeah, and gypsy and jazz and blues. And they've got a 4-piece horn section, and they're great. They're absolutely great.
You know, I think you're their biggest fan. You've given them a lot of attention through the years, and they're lucky to have you. I need to go see them one time. Hey, real quick, I want to say shout out to one of our listeners, Sparky, who is in the hospital, and he's listening online to us right now.
Sparky, who used to work here?
No, different Sparky. Okay. And so we hope you get better. He's only supposed to be there a few more days, and we just want you to heal. And this is how loyal some of our listeners are.
That's
They'll
great.
Listen while they're laid up in the hospital.
Good health to you, my friend.
Yes.
And, well, since we're giving shout-outs, I want to give one to Mary in Livonia, who actually sent us something through postal mail.
Oh, we got some snail mail?
Snail mail, indeed. It was a couple of articles that she found in the AFSCME, which is the American Federation of State Municipal Employees, which is one of the groups that is going to be suing against this
the bankruptcy finding.
Yeah.
They had a couple of they've had several big protests. Downtown.
Yeah,
and several of their members were arrested. Weren't there like 20
sure.
or 30 of them arrested?
Yeah. In protest against these proceedings, which we will talk about in a minute. But if you'd ever like to write us, you can just write Night Call or Peter Werby or Jolene Jordan. And it's care of WRIF, 1 Radio Plaza, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Fabulous, funky Ferndale.
Yes.
Right. We have a Facebook page, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. Debbie in Western Massachusetts, thank you so much for doing
it. I didn't post the guests up there. I'm sorry.
She did.
Oh, she did? Oh,
yeah,
Debbie,
yeah.
You are a lifesaver.
You're down, but you still haven't gotten your computer yet.
Well, yeah, but I'm not feeling well, but I'm so dedicated to this show and this city and this station.
You're not going to start talking about hurling again, are you?
No, I don't feel that sick.
Good.
I'm going to get through it.
Anyways, facebook.com/nightcall. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, to the bankruptcy. Now, one of the things, most people trying to think how to really pose this. I mean, to have critical thinking, to be able to make sense of the whole world, you have to have some what's called a perspective, some window through which to view all events. And I don't mean to, you know, a rigid ideology or anything like that.
Wow, that's a whopper.
What?
Rigid ideology.
I thought I messed that up. A rigid ideology. Yeah, maybe it sounds the same. But in any event, because you want to have flexible thinking as well. But if every time something happens, you have to start reinventing the wheel, usually you'll get it wrong because you'll get whipped up by the immediacy of what's happening. There are people that are out there who are paid professionals to give you wrong information.
Yes.
and wrong ideas, and they'll always tell you it's him or her or they or them or because whatever. But here's one of the things that I do. And Jolene, every Sunday, prints off all of these stories that we're going to talk about. And they're always on this incredibly clean white paper because they're just come out of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder where I'm going with this, right?
What, that I need to use that recycled paper?
No. That's another thing. But I have these articles that are dog-eared, that are dirty. Well, they're not really dirty. Not like my hands are dirty. But anyway, because I keep reading them all the time and reading them sometimes on the air. But actually, all that is needed is just the headlines for this.
Okay.
This is one way, well, I would say it is the way to view what is going on in 98% of what goes on in our lives and in the world. Here, this is one headline. Richest 300 persons on earth have more money than poorest 3 billion.
Yes.
I don't even know, and I won't try because I've been warned about this to do the math, but I don't know what percentage 300 people are of 3 billion. And there is a relationship. The reason that these 300 people have more than the 3 billion, well, they're rich because the other 3 billion are poor. Well, let's get a little down to home. Right here. 400 richest Americans worth more than the gross domestic product of Canada and Mexico.
My gosh.
That's 400 mostly men.
You know, outrageous.
Right. And here are the last one. 6 Waltons. Those are the folks that own Walmart.
We sure like to get on them, don't we?
Have more wealth than the bottom one-third of all Americans. So a lot of what's going on is this, what we learn about is the scrambling for pennies at the bottom. And these pennies are very important to the people to whom a penny is very, very
important.
And you
know who you are. And a lot of us are in that position.
Yeah. And so the stuff about health care and pensions and what have you. $18,000, which is the average pension for a Detroit pensioner, someone who worked for the city, and now it looks like their pension could be looted in order to pay off the banks, according to this bankruptcy findings. I don't know. Maybe that's what, I don't know what $18,000, what that would play in the life of one of these Waltons, for instance. What could they have it in their front pocket? It is way, way, way less than than Alice Walton, who runs this, who bought this huge art museum. What's the name of their, what's the city in Arkansas now? Is it Bennington?
Or I can't remember.
Or is that the name of that clothing manufacturer?
I don't even know if that's still around.
Yeah, I never heard of that in a while. So I don't even know what $18,000 would be to them. But, for instance, they keep saying Detroit is $18 billion in debt. If we took the $18 billion, or they somehow got some idea of generosity, started reading the national press and saw how prominent Detroit was, and said, these poor people, you know, a lot of rich people have, they like to give to charity. You know, they feel badly for the poor, even though their wealth is what's caused the poverty. And we'll talk, if you don't think that, give us a call at 248-544-WRIF.
They have these, rich women have these charity balls, charity parties.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's just so
I know someone.
It's a little repulsive.
Very wealthy family, lives in West Bloomfield. And a couple of winters ago, she saw on television these poor people. You're just liquid pouring just a little brandy to.
Maybe that's what I need.
Yeah. Saw these poor people sleeping on steam grates in downtown Detroit. She was so moved by it, and I am not criticizing her in the slightest. There's not going to be any buts here at all. She went out, bought all these blankets, and went down, found these poor people, and gave them blankets.
Well, good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Of course, that does nothing to get them off the grates. Just makes them warmer. Because we consider...
It's not solving the overall problem.
Yeah, and we consider
people.
The poor of the world and the poor of this country. Somewhere in the Bible it says the poor will always be with us. The poor will always be with us as long as we have a class structure that rewards so many people disproportionately and others, people that even work real hard, very poorly. And by the way, so if the Waltons said, well, you know what, look at all those people in Detroit. They're going to have their pensions cut. All the services are going to cut back. They're going to sell off the Detroit Institute of Art artwork. They're going to do all this stuff. They're going to have enough to pay off at least part of the banksters that caused all of it in the first place. But if they wrote a check for $18 billion, you know what this headline would say? Six Waltons have more wealth than the bottom 30% of Americans. They wouldn't change.
That's right.
I mean, that's how much money these people have.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So there has been a finding, which I think almost everybody knows, by a federal bankruptcy judge, Stephen Rhodes, who said that what they describe here is a battered city that could now formally enter bankruptcy, and asserted that Detroit's obligation to pay pensions in full was not untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here is the deal. So contracts, promises, expectations, the Michigan Constitution and all that mean absolutely nothing. Now, when you go into bankruptcy, contracts can be abrogated. There's no doubt about that. But what about our Constitution? I mean, what has happened here? This has been one-man rule. Democracy has been blown out totally. Now, here's what's happening. The governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, appointed a man to be the dictator of Detroit.
Yes.
Kevin Orr. He's the financial emergency manager. And then this was Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, brought this before a judge who then said that this is all blown out, that, you know, doesn't matter, that, for instance, that the emergency manager law was voted out by the people of the state of Michigan in the last election or the election before. Well, let me see, it was in November of the year before.
A year ago.
Yeah. And so what did the Republicans do? They just said, oh, the people of Detroit, I'm sorry, excuse me, the people of Michigan do not want an emergency manager law because they realize how destructive it is and how undemocratic it is. We'll just pass another one real quickly.
We'll just ignore them.
Yeah, we'll ignore them, and we'll get one man to appoint one man who will appeal to one man to abrogate these contracts for thousands of people. And it doesn't matter. The Michigan Constitution says pensions are secure. Doesn't mean anything. All right. Detroit's in trouble. A lot of cities are in trouble.
Yeah.
Illinois has like $100 billion of pensions that are in trouble. And one thing, nobody is asking Detroit to pay up $18 billion tomorrow, on Monday. This is long-term obligation. Still, the tax base has been eroded by the destruction of industrialism because these people did not want to pay living wages, middle-class wages, so they went where they could exploit workers like they used to exploit workers here in the United States in the 19th century into the 20th century till
those people went out and fought.
Fought for a middle-class wage. They said, look, folks, we're not revolutionaries. All we want is a decent wage and a decent set of work rules and 8 hours a day.
A decent life. Everyone deserves. Yeah. Says, rest in peace, Nelson Mandela.
Yeah. And you can still be the rich. You can still buy the politicians. You can still run the show. All we want to do is be able to send our kids to college. We want to get braces for them when they need it. We want to be able to have maybe a cottage up at Higgins Lake or something like that. But they said, no, we can make more money because we can do to Mexican workers, destroy their communities, impoverish them, create huge slums like in Mexico City, just like they did in Europe, just like they did in the United States, and now just like they're doing all through Asia, in China, in Bangladesh, and what have you. That's the nature of capitalist production. And the idea that rather than going forward and that there be some, justice, some economic justice, it's absolutely going the other way. Because when you start looking at those headlines where 300 people have more money or as much money as 3 billion people, something's really wrong. Do you think that, it's a meritocracy? In other words, these people were so smart, so skilled, so brilliant, had such business acumen that they were able to amass this fortune. Of course, they were giving jobs, not to these 3 billion people, or if they did, it was like in Bangladesh for $38.
A month.
Yeah, I was going to say, not an hour,
no.
Not a day, not a week, but a month.
Wow.
Yeah, and the reason they're not having textile production and clothing production like in North Carolina, because of the temerity of those American workers there that actually wanted something like $18 or $19 an hour. Yeah, so they thought, well, wait a minute. Why should we buy people's work time, their lives, for $18 an hour, $22 an hour?
Close it down and ship it off.
Yeah, when we can, and they say, hey, you know, we just buy from these contractors. What?
And you know, there is starting to be somewhat of a backlash in Bangladesh. I really hope that it makes a difference because there have been a couple of pretty nasty fires due to unsafe conditions. These people are working themselves to the bone for nothing. And, it's just wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's just wrong.
When we were in high school, they used to read this book about the meat industry called
The Jungle.
The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. Those working conditions, those are good ones compared to what a lot of people work for to make probably every stitch of clothing I have on right now.
Yeah, right.
Right? Yeah. So, back to Detroit. So, why is Detroit in the shape it's in?
Well, I thought you were going to say something else in the
yeah.
Which it is.
Well, you know why Detroit's so bad? Because they run it now. Used to be such a nice city, but now they run it.
Who's they?
Yeah, well, think about it.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But this
is just
awful. What has happened is with deindustrialization, with the tax base eroding, with the poor being the fastest growing class in the United States, with the middle class dropping in terms numerically and in terms of wealth and income, and all of it going to the high side. You know, those Republicans, those conservatives are always talking about class war and, you know,
redistribution
of wealth. It absolutely is going on. There absolutely is class war. And folks, we are losing. We are losing badly.
And they're happy about it.
Well, yeah, they're making more and more money. They can buy a, it was this Francis Bacon triptych, a painting, three-paneled triptych for $148 million. Let me write you a check here. Yeah, an Andy Warhol thing, something was called Silver Accident or something like that. I think that went, you know, just tens of millions of dollars. I mean, these folks don't even know what to do with their money. They have so much up at the upper end. And
rich people problems.
Absolutely. And when you think about these retired workers, you know, it's funny. You can say people have a lot more sympathy for first responders, for the police retirees and fire retirees. They're making 18, 20 grand a year. And a lot of them, I think the police, for instance, are not, maybe if there's some of you Detroit police listening.
You mean their pensions?
Their what?
Are 18 grand a
year. Yeah. Okay. Maybe if some of you are listening, I think I'm correct. I think police do not get Social Security. Some jobs don't, like some teachers.
I can find out.
Yeah. Well, they can call, too. 248.
Yes.
544-WRIF. So people say, oh, well, and they say, but the rest of them, you know, all they were doing was doing their jobs that they were required to do and what they are promised. Wait, let me see if I can find
this. Being a cop in the city of Detroit is not like being a cop in the burbs, let me say that.
Well, but what I was trying to say, yeah, so people do have more sympathy for those first responders. What about somebody that was just issuing a permit to...
Working in an office
this. But here, Dean Baker, who I've interviewed any number of times, he's in the past 2 days, we've seen a federal judge rule that Detroit can go bankrupt, putting its workers' pensions in jeopardy. And we have seen Illinois legislature vote for a substantial cut in its retirees' pensions. I mean, I can't imagine why, and I'm not out there either, why we're not doing like they do in Ukraine.
Well, what's that?
Oh, there's hundreds of thousands of people on the streets.
Oh, in the streets.
With these demands.
Or in a lot of these Middle Eastern cities, you know.
Well, like it was. But this is going on right now. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. In Kiev, they still had a statue of V.I. Lenin, you know, the communist leader. Yeah, they just pulled it down. It was great. It says, undoubtedly, these two actions are just the tip of the iceberg. Now, every one of you who has a pension, listen to this.
That's got to be a little scary to hear.
Dean Baker says, these two actions are just the tip of the iceberg. We have opened up a new sport for America's elite, pension theft. The specifics of the situation are very different, but the outcome is the same. Public employees who spent decades working for the government are not going to get the pensions that were part of their pay package. And he expands on that. In both cases, we have governments claiming poverty, and therefore the workers are just out of luck. Before getting the specifics of these cases, it's worth dealing with a couple of points. First, there has been a huge media campaign to trumpet the generosity of the public sector pensions. And there's been some ridiculous cases. But in the case of Detroit, the typical pension is a bit more than $18,000 a year. In Illinois, it's around $33,000. It's important to note that most Illinois workers, and it says most Detroit police, do not get Social Security. So this is their whole retirement income.
How can you not get Social Security? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Someone's got to enlighten us about that.
Yeah.
Because when you're on other, I mean, it could be that you never paid into it. If you're a teacher from the time, say, you were 23 and worked for 35 or 40 years.
Does everyone have to pay into that? That's why I'm confused.
Okay. Someone let us know. 248-544-WRIF. I know two people. One who was a worker for must have been the county. And someone else, and a friend of ours in California, was a teacher.
Okay.
Neither who get Social Security.
Interesting.
But actually have a fairly generous
pension.
It did. Yeah. Let me see. The other item generally missing from the coverage that these pensions are part of workers' pay, The other item generally missing from the coverage that these pensions are part of workers' pay. Controlling for education and experience, public sector pay is somewhat lower than the pay of private sector workers. The more generous pension and health care benefits that most public sector workers enjoy are offsetting lower wages. The pensions are not gifts bestowed by the government on workers. They are part of workers' pay. When the city of Detroit or state of Illinois cut workers' pensions, they are in effect saying that they are not going to pay workers for the work they did.
Mm.
So I wonder if this is...
How do you go back on that?
Yeah.
That's just...
Yeah, yeah. You know what I want to do? And we have people waiting to talk. I'm not even... Don't even have that screen up. Yeah. We're going to be the one talk show and news show that's not going to talk about the passing of Nelson Mandela, although you did in passing.
We're not?
Oh, you want to? Okay.
Well, why wouldn't we?
Okay. Well, part of it is the way that the conservatives always hated him and...
Right.
Called him a terrorist and a communist.
Well, the one thing that I'd like to say about that is it's interesting. A producer here in the building asked me, and he wanted me to ask you this as well, is name one living human being now currently on this planet who could fill those shoes.
Yeah. Well, it's tough.
I know. I'd like to know if anyone has any ideas. And he said he thought... Well, like people who should speak at the funeral. I think the funeral was today. I didn't see any of it, but he said he could see. I said Aretha should sing at it. Stevie should sing at it. and Billy C. Billy Clinton.
Oh yeah. I suppose. But, you know, let's do this. I want to talk about the bankruptcy, and I want to particularly know, Jalene and I.
Oh, and guess what? We have a retired police officer on the line.
Well, so. let me get him on here first, then, and because... We will get...
Oh, and an EMS for Detroit as well.
All right, we'll do that. I wanted to raise some question that was a little lighter, but this is pretty heavy. So
what
let's
we're
get
talking
to that.
About.
Yeah. All right, let's get Enrique. He's a retired police officer. So enlighten us, Enrique. What's going on? You're on the air. Oh, wait a minute. I guess that didn't work. I thought it did.
No, you are.
Yeah. Enrique, wait a minute. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, my apologies. I'm new to radio. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah. We didn't. The reason why we were not eligible for Social Security is because we didn't pay into FICA, and neither did the city of Detroit have to pay for that. So that's why we're not eligible. You know, if we were to get, I guess, our units after retirement, then we would be eligible, but. But during our 25 years, we don't pay into FICA, so therefore you don't have any units. And when you go for Social Security, you're not eligible.
Well, how does that work, though? Because some public sector employees do not have to pay into that. And Jalene was saying, we thought that everybody had to. What's the exclusion there? What's it based on?
To be honest, I really couldn't tell you. I just... my understanding was just that the city didn't have to pay, and neither did we have to pay into FICA.
Okay. Are you a Detroit retired officer?
Yes.
Yeah, so are you worried?
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
You know, we're very concerned, and, you know, the worst part is that we really don't know how much of a cut it's going to be. You know, we expect... cuts, but you know, how deep are they going to be? You know, when they talk substantially, that's very concerning, because it's not like some of us can just get up and find another job. You know, some of us are disabled, some of us have no you know, that's all we really know is sometimes just being a police officer.
We understand that, Peter. All we know is radio. I mean, I really do understand that.
Yeah.
And then just to pick up and you know, try to get back to work again. It's like, yeah, we would love to. If we need to, we'll do what we have to do. But it's just, you know, like you just said, it's just not that easy.
Okay, well, Enrique, I appreciate that. And I hope, one of the things that the bankruptcy judge, the federal judge, said that he was not going to allow really deep cuts. But if some people that are making like $18,000 say they only took $2,000 away only, I mean, if you're a multimillionaire, $2,000, like you say, you know, you use that for your floral arrangements, $2,000 to someone making $18,000, that's a real hefty cut. Yeah.
And that's the difference between, having a home and being homeless. Yeah, that's everything.
You got it.
That
all
is
right.
For sure. Yeah, because you have it, you have your finances all set. Everything has a, you're spending that money to live. And then you've already probably, a lot of people have cut back at this point in their lives. So there's no more else to cut back for some people.
Sure. Well,
there's none whatsoever.
Right. Yeah. Understand.
Don't have that option.
Thank you for your call.
Right.
We've got an active EMS from Detroit on the line. Maybe he can shed a little light as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Enrique.
Yeah, and I hope things work out. Wow. Hey, Adam. Hi. You're on the air. What's your take on this bankruptcy thing?
Well, here's something a little bit sickening even more. I work for a private company that does respond for calls in the city of Detroit. I start at $10 an hour, and you have people who work at fast food restaurants begging and asking for $15 an hour.
Right.
I save people's lives. They flip burgers.
I think you all deserve $15 an hour. I think you deserve $20.
Yeah. Well, careful here, Adam, because one of the things that often has occurred within the labor movement is pitting one sector of it against the other. Because believe me, if there's an organized effort, and I sympathize with you completely about your wage.
Yeah.
A friend of mine was EMS. Somehow I thought I imagined him making, because he had been in the Air Force and everything. And he was even a Teamster. And I think he was making like $13 an hour. I thought he'd be making like $30 or $40.
Oh,
yeah. You're not union, right?
No, all private EMS is non-union, I think, except for one company in the state of Michigan that is union.
Wow.
Now, on top of all this, we are supposed to support a family on $10 an hour.
It's impossible.
And our raises aren't. Yeah, it is. It's absolutely impossible. And for what we do, I mean, I've had guns held to my head. I've been in pretty scary situations, and we pay $10 an hour.
No, that's not, because people keep talking about a minimum wage. What we really have to look at is a living wage. And a living wage is $15 an hour. And if a lot of the emphasis now is now on the fast food workers, it would behoove you and benefit you to support them. Because if they're making $15 an hour, or, I doubt if they're going to get that, or 12 or 13, and all of a sudden Adam and other people that are doing this absolutely critical work that, is so important to the health of the community, there's no way in the world they could justify continuing to pay you 10. So one of the things that'll happen, that phrase about...
flipping burgers.
No, about, what is it, a rising sea lifts all boats. So, give those
support
folks some support.
Other. Yeah.
Right. All right, speaking of all that, I don't know, I've got to do a few little bits of business myself here. So thank you for calling, Adam. God, that's terrible. $10 an hour for those folks?
Oh, I can't
$10
imagine.
An hour for anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
make
I
sense.
Agree. I agree.
All right. When we come back, I want to keep talking about this. And Justin from Westland has some comments about Social Security as well. Maybe the information we need. We'll give you our Mr. Announcer. We'll give you the announcer. But
it's not
also.
In that, actually.
Oh.
It's 313. Oh, wait. 515. Wait, 248, where am I? What city? What time is it?
Where's 515? Des Moines?
Yes, that's my hometown. I actually, you can tell I'm not feeling well. I'm all over the place.
So 248.
Look, the phone lines are ringing. 248-544-9743. Give us a call.
All right, and I want to talk about a new Republican bill that would allow smoking at Michigan outdoor cafes and patios. And this, we'll interweave this with the much more important thing, which Detroit's bankruptcy. Right back.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call. Night call.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
Holy Cross Children's Services helps thousands of vulnerable and forgotten kids here in Michigan. Just like Davion, who's been bounced from home to home his whole life, until he came to Holy Cross.
I am 13 years old. When I got to Holy Cross, they got me to what I say a perfect family. They did a lot for me. I met Miss Asbury and Uncle Greg, and they helped me get to the place that I am now. They helped me get adopted. And I've been waiting my whole life for that. They asked me what I wanted for my birthday. And all I said I wanted to do was get adopted. And now I am. And by meeting Uncle Greg, I have a huge family. Like my grandfather, my grandmother, cousins, uncle. It's the best present in the world. And Holy Cross did that for me. And they can do that for other kids, too.
Please, help other kids like Davion. For donations of $120 or more, you'll receive our Michigan Christmas Hope CD. And every dollar is matched by the Holy Cross Board, too. Call 1-855-355-GIVE. That's 855-355-GIVE. Or go to nochildforgotten.org. Thank you.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. You can get a hold of us through email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Tis the season. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Winston Smith writes in, Peter, we've had enough of Mandela eulogies by now. It's been on every TV channel to the exclusion of everything else. Everything and anything there is to be said about the man has been said, so please spare us.
Well, I tend to agree with him.
Yeah, we spared you. All right. Although I may talk about how the conservative movement hated Nelson Mandela, supported the Republicans, Reagan, all the rest of them, supported apartheid. I mean, pretty amazing.
I think that's pretty important information.
Well, maybe
there,
we'll get that on
Winston
later. Let me see. I've totally lost my. Oh yeah, here it is. Boy, these computers. All right. I want to get some people on again about why some people don't have to pay into Social Security.
And why they therefore then do not get it.
Yes. But I wanted to also raise this. There's legislation that would roll back a provision of Michigan's restaurant smoking ban. It would allow people to smoke while dining at sidewalk cafes or patios outside of restaurants.
Oh, I know you love this, Peter.
Yeah. 10 Republicans have signed on, and they actually have Democrats from Roseville and Taylor. Are also co-sponsors. And they're gathering, I guess this is an older one, so they gathered on Wednesday night at our cigar bar in Rochester to puff on stogies, talk up the bill, and raise money for its chief sponsor, State Representative Tom McMillan. He doesn't even smoke.
He
wants you to be able to die and to kill other people, you know. I mean, we used to say why you shouldn't smoke around people was suicide, yes, murder, no.
I know.
Right? But
there's a lot of people who smoke here at this in this radio business.
And an Oak Park man who I actually know, Marx Cooper, he's campaigned for decades to make Michigan's restaurant smoke-free, predicted the bill would flop. The head of the Royal Oak Restaurant Association said she preferred to keep her establishment 100% smoke-free indoors and out, even though she used to smoke and originally opposed the ban on smoking in restaurants that passed in 2009.
I mean, our people, and by the way, don't be impatient. A couple people have hung up, so I want to just let you know we will get to you, Vincent and Paul, and whoever else calls in.
Right.
We'll get to you.
And let's see. This Republican says, countless other bar and restaurant owners see the ban as blatant overregulation and usurping the rights of business owners to make their own rules on their own property. The only thing is that 400,000 people a year die from smoking-related problems, and that cost is socialized, right? Smoking is socialism. Because the cost of the damage it does to health is socialized. We all wind up paying for it in one way or another. And
I think, isn't everyone kind of used to it out there? Aren't you used to not being able to smoke? And it seems weird now to me that we were ever...
Sure.
Doing that.
Well, it's real popular to show all these 50s series, Mad Men. Some of them, the people are smoking on airplanes and smoke
doctors. Oh, I remember that.
They used to. I have ads at my house that have doctors recommend Chesterfield.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
isn't
it smooths
that crazy?
It smooths my throat. Or singers would say it smooths their throat.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. Well, you know, a long time ago it was probably a little more natural. You know, now they have so many chemicals in them, unless you smoke those American Spirits that are chemical-free. But they have chemicals to make them burn faster, so you smoke more, and there's all kinds of stuff in there.
That's what one number of people say, that it's the chemicals that are really the killer.
Yeah.
But somehow, ingesting a lot of smoke doesn't seem like the best idea.
But what about, you know, American Indian rituals and... You know.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's smoking a little. Anything in moderation, you got to figure out what moderation is, too.
Yeah, true.
But here, one of the supporters of this bill that would allow smoking in outdoor places, and what do you think? Think we ought to go back to it? I say absolutely not. 248-544-WRIF. One supporter of this bill is Rod Lockwood of Birmingham, and he was the chair of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. And he's a wealthy developer who made headlines in January when he proposed buying Belle Isle for $1 billion. Folks, if you're listening from elsewhere, that's an island park in the middle of the Detroit River that's going to be turned into this gem again. But he wanted to turn it into a separate state with no taxes.
Please.
Okay. All right.
Come back down to earth, baby.
I want to get Vincent on because he's calling from so far away. He's probably in, he is in Arizona. Hey, Vincent, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
We're good. What's up? What about the Social Security thing?
Well, I was kind of thinking about everything as I was driving my way. I'm in Michigan right now. I took a little trip, and it's frustrating to see everything in the shape that has become so decrepit and more or less as a whole, how we're going to fix this. I mean, we were built on a capitalistic society, and, you know, I feel for Adam. Like, that whole situation is just terrible. You know, I mean, it is incredibly debatable, but at the same token, it's like, okay, well, if you're working at a fast food joint, I mean, what have you done to better yourself? You know, what have you done to provide for your family? Or, you know, are you going back to school? Are you, you know, creating a new invention? Are you starting a business? I mean, there's so many different things.
Well, wait. Let me just stop you right there.
Yeah, because let me stop
you.
I don't, what is this looking down your nose kind of thing toward people who work in the fast food industry? I mean, that just really upsets me.
Why would
it really upsets me that people think it's just such a low life thing to do.
Well, let me ask,
some people don't want to work at all. At least they're working.
And let me add to that and ask you.
I'm not trying to be mean.
Do you think if everybody got the best education they could and everybody was as ambitious as possible, there would then be no fast food workers?
No, of course not.
So in other words, it's a class stratification that has to be filled. If everybody in this country got a PhD, you know what? There'd be people working at McDonald's
with a
PhD in French Renaissance history making $8 an hour. It's a class system, my friend, that relegates a certain sector of the population to great wealth and opulence and privilege and power. Very, very small sector. We call it the 1%. And then at the bottom, in terms of wages, not in terms of who are due respect, is what Jolene was getting at, are the people that fill the other roles. Huh?
I understand completely what you're saying in that respect, although at the same token, I mean, it almost seems like you're pushing for a socialist society where, you know, we redistribute wealth and...
Well, wait a minute. It is
okay,
getting distributed, but it's
ding,
all getting
ding,
distributed
ding.
Up.
I've got you figured out, Vincent.
yeah. You're right. There ought to be a massive redistribution of wealth. Why should five people in one family who never did a day's honest work in their life, the Waltons, the heirs of Sam Walton who owns Walmart, why should they be worth more than, have more money than the bottom, five of them, have more money than the bottom third of this
country?
The entire population who worked their butts off.
Yeah, and meanwhile, while they're doing that, sitting back enjoying their wealthy lives, they are paying their low wages to their employees. They're treating them horribly, and they're putting up signs break rooms saying, here's how you apply for government assistance. Now, don't you think there's something a little wrong with that picture, Vincent?
Oh, absolutely. I think that those particular instances or specifics, those are horrible. Agreed. But those who actually built their wealth, you know, I've seen it day in, day out. I work in the finance industry, and I see customers who've you know, built businesses from ground up. I mean, they're very wealthy. They're not, I don't necessarily call them the 1%, but they're very wealthy. But I don't necessarily think you should rob from them to pay for those who are sitting back on their rear.
No, but how about how about a wealth tax that after you get you know, socially figure the wealthiest country in the world we live in. And yet, cities, not just Detroit, but Pennsylvania, Illinois are having trouble with their pensions, Bakersfield, California, Stockton, California.
It's a trend. It's not slowing down.
So this is setting the stage, and this is going to be the setting the stage for looting all of these pensions. And if you're in the financial industry, you know that people, they're not creating jobs. Some of these people are. I mean, that's what the stock market initially was all about, to capitalize firms so people could get money that they didn't have on their own and then pay dividends to the people that invested. Now it's just a big crap game in the sky. So, I mean, I don't even know why they got so mad at Bernie Madoff. I mean,
Peter.
I mean, that just seemed like,
that's like everyday action,
yeah.
Right?
And you read, I don't know if you read the New York Times business section, but it's like the police gazette. I mean,
of white collar crime.
Yeah.
Hey, Vincent, I have a question for you as you live in Arizona. Do you like your governor?
I mean, to be quite frank, I mean, from what I've seen and what they've done,
yeah.
I mean, I have no complaints. I mean, I go about my day. I mean, I work my rear off every single day, and I put in what's necessary to make sure I can provide for myself, my family. You know what I mean?
Well,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
But here, according to this report from, where is this? It's called Fast Food Giants Starve Workers' Wages and Gorge on Taxpayers. And here's what that means. Fast food CEOs rake in taxpayers' subsidized pay. Oh, this is the name of it. Published by the Institute for Policy Studies. Current tax codes allows corporations such as Taco Bell, KFC, Pizza Hut, and McDonald's, quote, to deduct unlimited amounts from their income taxes for the cost of stock options, certain stock grants, and other forms of so-called performance pay for top executives, meaning that the more corporations pay their top earners, the less they pay in federal taxes. The report also said over the past 2 years, CEOs of the top six publicly held fast food chains, these are six guys, brought home over $183 million in deductible performance pay, which in turn reduced their company's taxes by an estimated $64 million. And Sarah Anderson from the Institute for Policy Studies said $64 million is enough to cover the average cost of food stamps for 40,000 American families for a year. Now, we subsidize, you and me, Vincent, and Jalene, everybody else that pays taxes, we subsidize every one of these fast food companies and Walmarts and all of that to the tune of billions and billions of dollars because they pay their workers so crappy so that the Walton family can be worth $120 billion. They pay them such bum wages that they are eligible for public assistance. So you and me, Vincent, are paying for their Medicaid.
And they're probably working their butts off like you are.
Yeah, so they're working, you know, they're working hard too. So let's just say, isn't there a song, say a prayer for the poor work? I can't remember. Salt of the Earth.
Okay.
Anyway, Vincent, I got to move on. Thank you very much.
I'm interested in hearing about this bumper sticker.
Yeah. Here's Paul from Sterling Heights. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
I email Peter from time to time, and you got to understand, I'm a retired Ford worker.
Okay.
I had to stand up to the diddlehead bullies.
The man.
Worked with when they told me that because I said I was liberal, I'm a traitor to America.
No.
Well, not in your, wait a minute, Paul, not in your union.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
These must have been guys from the East Side.
Peter.
The Reagan Democrats, man.
Yeah. Well, I hope those guys have, you know, we know Bob King, who was the president.
He still is. He's not done yet.
Isn't he done?
No,
he hasn't been
president of the UAW.
Okay, he found out that a third of UAW workers voted for the Republicans. He was beside himself.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, anyhow, so I just send you my ideas when they come to me. Lately, I've been wanting to make up a bumper sticker that says, "Visit Michigan for a taste of dictator."
There you go.
Okay.
I mean,
get it out there.
Yeah, when I was standing up to those bullies, the first thing that came to mind was, if it wasn't for liberals, America would still be British. But I refine that down. You're going to love this refinement.
Okay.
My refinement is, if it wasn't for liberals, there would be no party of Abraham Lincoln.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, Paul, I go through this litany of the conservatives, who I say that we would have been British still. They were the ones that, the conservatives were the ones that wanted slavery in the Constitution. They're the ones that backed slavery. They're the ones that...
God, we could just stop there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're the ones that caused the Civil War, on and on, segregation, and yada, 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 you know. All right, yeah, get it on your car. Thank you, Paul.
Send
I appreciate
one.
It. Yeah. Let's go back to the $15 an hour. There's just, there was strikes in 100 cities around the country, and,
they're not slowing down.
No, demanding $15 an hour, which would mean a 67% pay increase in
wow.
the industry where wages average around $9 an hour. That's not a living wage. And these are not part-timers. Some are. They are not high school students. Some are. These very, very frequently are adults that are being smashed by this class system that benefits the rich. And, they get richer. Because if the rich had to pay $15 an hour to their workers, they would have less money. This is redistribution of income. This, finally, these workers, and a lot of this is instigated, and well, that it should be, by the unions. This is finally answering the class war attack. The capitalists at the top, the rich, the 1%, launched 30 years ago a class war battle to take back what they had lost in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. And the 60s. And they said, wait a minute, we got an opening. They got guys like Reagan in there that developed this Reaganomics. What we saw the result of it was our big recession that a lot of you are still in. So $15 an hour, this would set the stage for everyone to get a raise. Because Adam, who was an EMS mm-hmm. in Detroit, and that's what happened. Don't join the party of resentment. Don't join the party of revolt, of revolution, of resistance.
Yes, yes, Peter.
Yeah.
Yes, Peter.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And that is, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Not I'm mad as hell because they want more money and and they don't deserve it. And not that idea. They're working at a fast food place and they don't deserve it.
That just drives me crazy.
Everyone deserves a living wage. Unless we want to just scrap the whole American experience. Now, it was like that. I mean, that workers, and working people in the working class were and have been just objects of production. And not thought of in any human way. The labor was for sale, and it didn't just get it at the cheapest cost. And when people said, hey, I want to raise my selling price, in other words, get more money, what did the bosses do? They called out the federal troops. They called out the strike breakers. They called out the goons. They called out the local police. Killed hundreds and hundreds of workers simply because they wanted a pay raise or they wanted an 8-hour day or something
like
that.
Or like Walmart, they'll just close the store
or
down.
Or they'll close the store. This is a little modern. And so now, they go, where's the resistance? Where's the organized pushback? Where's the fighting spirit of people that are getting screwed? And they don't see it.
It's there, and it's growing.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
They're getting worried. And actually, the system is so wealthy that they can afford this.
Yeah.
And if you and we really go at it, We'll get it.
Yeah. And one more thing on the fast food issue is that it would raise, one of the complaints, it would raise food costs. Well, it's really not that much. Instead of a $3 hamburger, you're going to pay $3.50. I mean, come on.
But you know what? What's that restaurant? I was going to go there and I forgot all about it. I hate to say it. Moo Moo Cluck? Cluck Cluck Moo Moo? Or?
Oh, Cluck. Cluck Moo.
Cluck Moo?
Cluck Cluck Moo.
Moo Moo Cluck.
Is it?
I don't know. Anyway, they pay their workers. A fast food place. First thing I thought, how can they have hamburgers for $3 and pay their workers $15? And they're doing it. And they're going to open up other branches. So they can do it. What it means is Richie Rich Kid has to make less money.
Yeah.
That's all.
And it's not that much less.
Yeah.
They're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Poor little babies.
Poor babies.
Aww.
All right. More, let me see, there was some other really crazy thing that I wanted to ask you about, but...
Well, we're looking for your phone calls. We have some calls coming in now, but we do have open lines, so
yeah.
One less hour.
Go to Facebook.com/nightcall. You'll see the interesting guest. This ought to be a controversial interview that I'm going to do at 1 o'clock with Michael Kimmel. He's written a book called Angry White Men.
Ooh.
And the first thing I ask him, wait a minute, Michael, aren't most men pretty angry of all colors? Why are you singling us out?
I can't wait to hear it. Hey, you know, there's some PO'd women, too.
Yeah.
You're looking at
one. And then, also, something on sports. Why Sports Matter. What's the name of it? One Game at a Time, Why Sports Matter, by kind of a radical sports writer.
Okay, well, yeah. that gives me...
Matt Hearn. Doesn't that sound like a sports guy?
Yeah, it does sound like a sports guy. And, you know, I'm not a big sports gal, so but that actually intrigues me. And, hey, Mike is in Jackson. He wants to talk about taxes, and we can take your calls, too.
All right, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
I'm a good gift giver. No, a fantastic gift giver. What do I get in return? An unnecessary cheek pinch. I deserve more. So this year, I'm giving Buffalo Wild Wings gift cards. Because for every $25 I spend, I get a $5 bonus coupon to give to myself. So the next time I hear, "Oh, that's so sweet," it better be referring to honey barbecue sauce. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings. Beer. Sports. Valid in restaurant at participating locations only. For a limited time while supplies last. Certain terms and conditions may apply.
Let me tell you about Charity Motors. If you're looking for a 2013 tax deduction, it's got to be Charity Motors, and here's why. This late in the year, if you donate your car to somebody else, you'll only be able to write off their sale price at the time of the sale. And at this point, it's most likely not going to sell by the end of the year, which means you're going to have to wait to write it off on your 2014 taxes. On top of that, the amount you write off is going to be a lot less than the fair market value. Not with Charity Motors. They're different. They're the only car donation program in Michigan who can guarantee the full fair market value tax deduction at the time of donation. Not when the car sells. Because Charity Motors is the only car donation program that sells your car only to low-income people who really need it. And, of course, it's only Charity Motors that allows you to pick the charity of your choice to receive the proceeds from your car donation. Get your fair market value tax deduction for 2013 guaranteed. Call them today at 888-908-CARS. They'll even pick up the car for you. Call Charity Motors right now at 888-908-CARS. Call Charity Motors for a guaranteed 2013 full fair market value tax deduction. CharityMotors.org. At Holy Cross Children's Services, every child matters. Just like Kevin, who until he came to Holy Cross felt hopeless and needed a second chance in life. Holy Cross never gives up on our kids.
Going through foster care, you know, most kids are always giving up on. And, you know, it's a sad thing, but, you know, we don't get many chances. So when I finally got to Holy Cross at the age of 16, you know, I was a bad egg. I was very bad, you know. But through my process of Holy Cross, I never was given up on. It's just like it's a second chance at life to me because, you know, I don't know where I would have been if I never went to Holy Cross, if I went to somewhere else. Like, I'm probably the most improved kid at Holy Cross. But it was only through the chances and the workers and all the help that they give you. You know, a lot of places don't give you help. They just see you as a dollar. So Holy Cross is an individual. So you need help, they're there.
Please help other kids like Kevin. For donations of $120 or more, you'll receive our Michigan Christmas of Hope CD. And every dollar is matched by the Holy Cross Board, too. So please call 1-855-355-GIVE. That's 855-355-GIVE. Or go to nochildforgotten.org. Thank you.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Tickets for DSO December 27th and maybe an upgrade to the front row. Details online at WRIF.com.
I want to hear the testimony. I want to hear the testimony. It's time to testify. I want to know. Are you ready to testify? Peter and Jolene. You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIX.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743. We would be remiss to not mention that now, as of yesterday, since it's midnight, was the anniversary of John Lennon's death 33 years
yes,
ago.
It was. Yeah, because we play him at the beginning of our show.
Yes,
right. Power to the people. What an idea. I think it's what motivated a lot of revolutions. What was that one? The American Revolution.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had someone call me earlier today and request Revolution, and I said, girl, you need to listen to my show at night.
Right.
We're all about that.
Hey, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. A lot of what's on there, although it... my site is labyrinthine. It's
sure
like
is.
A labyrinth, right? I can't even follow it. But a lot of the highlights of it are at our Facebook page, just facebook.com/nightcall. One of the things we were talking about was this push for $15 an hour. And a lot of that is on stuff about that is on my Facebook page, our Facebook page, excuse me, and on my...
your website.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm trying to scroll through this. Can't find it. Because there was a big, on December 5th, there was hundreds of cities, people gathered to fight for living wages and what they call shared opportunity. And I thought there was more, dignity and a living wage. And you can understand that push for dignity because when you get people downing people that are low wage.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, and boy, I don't know if this is going to set anybody off or anything like that, but here's what I have.
Like, do you really care?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to hurt people's feelings, but, you know, these idiots at Fox News, one of the ways they, one of the pieces of raw meat they, that they throw to their listeners is this whole thing about the war on Christmas.
Oh, jeez. Right? Every year we have to go through this.
So I have on my website, keep the X in Xmas, right?
Okay.
Well, here's why. And it's not insulting to Christians because, really, is it really a Christian holiday? Do people function? Is it
no, it's a pagan holiday.
Well, no.
The origins.
But it's...
It's a commercial holiday.
It's a retail shopping celebration, not a religious holiday.
Yeah.
So happy holidays, folks.
You know, whatever. We were just talking about this before the show, and I just was expressing my disdain for this holiday. I'm not even going to apologize. You can call me a bah humbug. You can call me Scrooge all you want. I can't wait for it to be over. The only thing that I love about the holidays is that I work a lot more.
I like to. That's an unusual.
I know.
I like it because I get a chance to drink more.
Oh, I got that nailed down. I'm good.
I got that nailed down. All right. Also on my website and on our Facebook page, the guests and, everything under the sun. Nice photographs of Jolene and I. I was looking at some of those. Talk about narcissism, right?
I was looking at us.
Yeah.
The other day.
What a handsome couple.
We would have had cute children.
But speaking... Is it too late?
Yes, I think so.
All right. Also, my wife would object.
Yeah, we'd have to go through that little hoop.
Yeah, we'd have to do that. Anyways, it also says on my website, stay out of the malls, buy gifts with meaning. And you can go to Peaceful Holiday Gifts. This is from, what's my friend? I can't even think of his website. But the other one is the Syracuse Cultural Workers. We always get our cards.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah, our greetings cards.
They have some of these things where you can buy goods that were made by women in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
I remember one year I bought some scarves from them, and there's a lot of things that you can do that are just a lot less, gross than what's going on.
It's peacebuttons.info. This was my friend Carl, who produces that little peace symbol button backed by popular demand.
Yeah.
And he has sold tens of thousands of these babies. He has a map somewhere on his, I'm just looking at the peaceful holiday gifts. We should play some holiday music. Like Timbuk3, do you remember them?
Yes.
They have this thing, All I Want for Christmas is World Peace. That's good.
Okay.
That's
but do good. We even have, I don't really even want to acknowledge it.
You don't want to do
sorry,
it?
Sorry, no.
How about...
I'm going to go to the Christmas party.
Yeah, because there's drink
good
there.
Food and all my friends. Yeah. And, you know.
The Howling Diablo, Detroit's own.
They're playing it?
No, no, no.
Oh.
I'm talking about a song. Christmas, they have a song, Christmas in Jail.
Oh, yeah, I remember that
That's
one.
That's a great number.
Yeah.
And what else? Ten Below Zero. That's another.
AC/DC. Don't they have it? Isn't it Mistress for Christmas?
I want a Mistress for Christmas. And one that they played all the time that I never really understood. Well, Santa Claus and His Old Lady. Cheech and Chong. That's really pretty rad when you get down to it.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
A lot of those songs. So is like for Thanksgiving, you know, Alice's Restaurant. You know, anti-war song.
I played it this year.
Did you?
Every year.
Yeah. It's so good to be played. And I
don't think I've ever actually sat and listened to the whole thing. My ADD is just rages.
And probably the most rad of all is Father Christmas by the Kinks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're going to knock down Father Christmas and take the toys from the rich girls and boys.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little violent even.
Well, they were kind of weird. Thought of as like kind of a punk band, right? A little bit punky.
Proto, yeah. All right, let's do this, by the way, because we're having a grand time, but there's a lot of people waiting. Yeah, $15 an hour. What do you think? Everybody should make that, I say. Minimum. All right, here is Mike. Mike is in Jackson. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I'd like to expand from last week. I'm still looking for a state to move to, and I'm hearing and reading interesting things about Texas, and I'd be interested in hearing your take on Texas. Fortune magazine has rated Texas the top state in America to do business. There are more Fortune 500 headquarters in Texas than any other state. That all these businesses are just flocking to Texas like a magnet based on minimal taxation, minimal regulation, and minimal litigation.
Sounds awful.
Litigation.
That must be awful for the average working person. I mean, it is expanding. I was just in Dallas a little while ago, a couple of weeks ago, and it's like Dubai or something like that. Everywhere you look, they're building freeways.
I do not enjoy Texas. The only place I would go if I were in Texas would be Austin.
Austin,
because I'm a musician.
What do you do, Mike? What do you?
I'm in sales, and I live in Jackson, and everything's closing up. We're just like a little Flint. I'm looking down the road. I think it's going to be like a Flint or a Benton Harbor. Everything's closing.
Wow.
Well,
you know, there is what I call this capitalist wheel of misfortune. You know, there used to be the wheel of fortune, or it's the capitalist wheel of fortune. So you never can tell where the needle is pointing. You know, it used to be, back in the day, Flint was just an incredible city. Now it's, one of the poorest cities in America. And so there's a lot of expanding in Texas because, what does that mean? Less regulations. Does it mean that, throw stuff in the river? Usually what these guys want. I don't know. Maybe we got some Texas listeners, but
the only thing happening in Jackson is the prison. It sounds like
that's not even there anymore, is it? Is Jackson?
They really cut back on the prison and just let Granholm just let everybody out in Jackson and stuff.
Wow,
cool.
Those liberals just open the doors. Thanks, Mike. Don't let the door hit you in the ass.
Oh, Peter! Happy holidays!
He's bailing out on us. Who cares? Let's see. Here is Anonymous. I hope you're not with that, or I hope you are with that internet hacker group, or you just don't want your name known.
I just don't want to name down, but all I want to say is I have a lot of respect for a lot of stuff you say because I don't agree with you, but that's what I like about what you say is because you're from a different mindset, and I respect your opinion.
Wow.
So I think it's awesome people can dispute different opinions intellectually.
Go ahead.
That's for the $15 an hour thing. My thing is it's an introductionary job. You know, if you're just getting into it, then awesome. It gives you a place to get started. If you want to make more, you move up in the company. Because one thing I got to say about McDonald's is they actually have, like, McDonald University where you can be making really good money if you choose to move up in it.
But not everyone everyone who works at McDonald's can go up there because there's not enough positions for everyone to do that. Do you understand that?
What percentage of fast food workers do you think get even over $10 an hour? These shift managers, what do they make? I think they make about 10 or 11. I mean, come on. It's a way to rip off people who have no other option, who are at the bottom of the class system in this society. And, what's the problem with getting these folks a living wage so they don't have the stress that comes with economic deprivation? And you know what these people would do with their $15 an hour? They would spend it, because when you, for instance, get more money, this was Reaganomics. You know, you got to roll back the taxes on people, roll back the regulation, and then all these rich folks would have more money to invest and create more jobs. The only jobs they really created were overseas, but most of them just put it in the, you know, in the stock market. So, but these folks, if you're making $8 an hour and all of a sudden your wage was almost doubled, you're going to be spending. So that would be $15 an hour to all fast food workers would be such an injection of capital into the retail market, don't you think?
Well, my other opinion I want to state is, you know, they also have people that do make minimum wage up for other subsidies they can go through, other government-based programs.
Well, yeah, but usually conservatives don't want to have to pay for other people. Why should we have to pay the Medicaid
for
a Walmart worker? Why doesn't Walmart pay it?
Well, my biggest opinion, I always say this, you know, people that start with a general position can work their way up. And a lot of people have a sense of entitlement, and they feel like they're just entitled. It's employee mindset. Employees always feel more entitled.
Gee. I mean,
are you kidding me?
These horrible people that think, you know what? What you really are advocating is something out of feudalism, where people know their place, that have no expectations other than the class status that they've been dealt, except for the talented tenth that could drive their way. These folks, and I talked to them, Gaia bless them, that they do three jobs, and they go to college at night, and they sleep 3 hours a night, and all that. But why in the world should people have to do that? I mean, why don't we have a system that lets the workers of the world relax?
Especially in an industrialized nation, especially in the United States of America, aren't we supposed to be number one?
Yeah.
Hell no.
Well, I don't think we should ever be relaxed with life. We should always be striving for more.
Well, I agree.
Hey, man, I don't agree with that at all. I love to relax. I'm the queen of relaxing. As hard as well.
What about the average person? The average person that is born into wealth, guess what happens to them? They get a cushy job and they continue to be wealthy. Maybe they don't, go way up to the top. But, if you're born in some of these wealthy suburbs and your parents are wealthy and all your connections are wealthy and you graduate college, maybe not even with such, because mostly you were just...
I mean, you just pretty much described my life.
You were partying. Well, no, but not this. But you were in a fraternity and, you got all your fraternity brothers. You wind up doing really well. If you're an average person and you're poor, you're an average person and you're working class, you're going to spend your whole life making $9 an hour.
Yeah.
And what we were telling that other guy, Anonymous, that if everybody strove to the extent they could, got the most incredible education imaginable, had the most ambition, guess what? The people would still be making $7.75 an hour.
Yeah.
Because it is not, there's not like a promised land of, I don't know what you call it, of good jobs. Everybody can't be a manager. They've got to have somebody that they've got to rip off for $7.75 an hour.
or doing the grunt work.
That's the nature of the system right now. All right. Thank you very much.
It seems like a lot of these conservatives, it's just like this kind of utopia that they have in their in their heads, that this is the way it should be, and if you do that, you get this. Well, you know what? Come down to earth, because that is not real. That is just not happening.
It is feudalism. I mean, the idea.
Sir, may I have another?
Yeah. You come with your hat in your hand, right? Those workers used to wear, what do you call them, slouch caps or caps? You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know.
You know, they're flat, those flat caps with a little bill on it.
Oh, like a little newsboy?
Yeah, a little newsboy thing, and you come and you kind of scrunch together and you say, please, sir, could we have another 10 pence.
Yeah.
You know, like some 19th century England or in the United States. The idea in the United States in the 19th century was work workers to death. And they did. Yeah, and they did. And they had all this whole idea among the industrial class and the ruling class and the elite and the financial classes that it was good for them because it taught them discipline.
That is just awful.
Yeah, yeah.
And why is it called
a rationalization for being evil.
Yes. And why, I don't understand people who don't have or don't want the best for every human being. Every human being on this planet deserves respect and dignity and a fair and living wage. Everyone deserves it. No one is exempt from deserving that.
248-544-WRIF. Let's see. Here's Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Hey, Fred. Welcome to the broadcast.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Fred.
I haven't called in for a while.
We miss you.
But the second week in a row, I've heard you mention Texas.
Mm.
And I wanted to bring up the fact that, you know, they do have the largest uninsured population down there, as well as a heavy population of low-wage workers.
Sure.
That's why the state is booming. Not to mention the fact they destroyed teachers' unions like everybody else. Now, as far as the overall fast food situation and the $15 an hour,
sure,
a huge fact that people are forgetting in this is that these businesses, they will not field a dedicated workforce. So a lot of folks aren't even getting 8 hours, 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day.
Right.
No, one of the things they're doing is cutting back beyond, forgot what's the legal.
35.
35, or no. I
34.
Think it's, well, whatever. 34. So they won't have to provide. So, so like Jimmy John's is putting all these people part-time so that he won't have to provide insurance for them. You know, he's like a multimillionaire and he wants to deny his workers health care. What a.
Yeah, and the crazy part about it is they actually sleep well at night. Isn't that scary?
Maybe they don't. I hope not. No, you know what, though? I'm sure they do.
They're heartless, right, Fred?
Oh, yeah. Now, I think I've been hearing some of your angry white men in the last three or four callers, and they seem to be ignoring all the cronyism and nepotism at the top that you've been talking about.
Sure.
Because the wealthy do make jobs and positions for people who kiss their behind so they can be wealthy, too.
Yeah, but let me...
They hope they can.
Yeah, let me tell people, the reason that Fred mentioned that phrase, angry white men, that's the name of a book, the author of whom I'm going to interview at 1 a.m. And I said, the first question I'm going to I asked him on this recorded interview was, why are you calling color here? Because it does seem like guys in general are kind of angry, right? And you know what? In fairness, Fred, though, I have to say those guys did not seem particularly angry. You know, he said, I've had people, maybe you're a longtime listener, and maybe.
But we've had some real angry ones.
They said, that's their money. How dare you? You know, they're like shaking with anger.
Fred, I wish you could see Peter when he says that.
They're from some working class suburb, you know, downriver or over on the east side, and they're angry because that we have the temerity to suggest that maybe these multi-billionaires ought to only have millions. I don't get it. But I suppose if the wealthy didn't have some constituency of deluded people, they would, the emperor would be naked, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. All right, Fred. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Appreciate your call.
Good to hear from you.
Let's see here. Continuing on, here is Carol in Ypsilanti. Carol, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. Love your show.
Well,
I try to listen to you guys as much as I can.
Appreciate it.
Hi, and I just wanted to make a comment. A little earlier, you were talking about fast food workers, and I was a fast food worker for more years than I care to remember, actually.
Yeah, right.
And I worked my fanny off, okay?
Thank you.
But that was okay, you know. But the wage I got was horrible. I raised two kids on it.
Wow.
I did get food stamps, however, because that was the only way I could even break even, if I could do that, if I was lucky.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm happy my tax dollars were part of that.
I did pay taxes too. Right, I was a taxpayer.
I'm happy that you were able to receive that assistance.
But wait a minute. Let me put a different spin on it. I am not happy because what should have happened is they should have been. Yeah, Carol should have been being paid a living wage, and her employer should have been providing health care, and the tax dollars that we paid could have gone to do the roads or save Detroit or something like that.
But that wasn't the situation. So fortunately. Right.
I just wanted to say that, you know, you were talking about the people there at Walmart and other places that were out, you know, protesting. Sure. Hey, I just want to say right on, people, right on.
See, there we go.
You guys have a good night.
All right, thank you, Carol. I mean, I feel our opinion and Carol in agreement with us is kind of like the minority. Go figure.
I don't know anymore, Peter? I don't know. It's hard to say.
I don't know. Hear a lot of people bitching about it.
Here's Brian in California. Brian, but you're calling from Detroit. Detroit number, huh? Go ahead. You're on the air. Did I not do this?
Hey, Peter. Hey, Lean. How you doing tonight?
Hi, Brian. Great.
Good. This is Big D, Detroit 420 show. Brian?
Oh, yeah.
How you guys doing?
We're doing good. That's right. You've got a Detroit exchange, but you're out in sunny. Is it sunny there, or is it snowing there, too?
It was beautiful. Well, it's a little cold tonight. It's down to like 40 degrees tonight. It was like 35 the night before last. It's a little cool in the desert. We're in a little place called Indio, California.
Oh, lucky you. That's a really cool place.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty nice. It is. It's just outside of Palm Springs. But anyway, we talked about the VA last time, and I got, you know, that was an interesting topic. But I worked at McDonald's when I was in high school. I was 15 years old, got a driver's license, and I was doing, lived out in Romeo, Michigan, 26 miles. Van Dyke, went to Washington, Michigan, and, elementary and then the high school, but in Romeo. But anyway, we worked at McDonald's when I was 15, right there at the Tank Automotive Plant there on Van Dyke in 10 miles, and 696 Van Dyke. And, I remember when the riots were going on, we had a curfew we had to be in. And we were making $2.65 an hour at that time. Wow. And, but, you know, that was pretty good for living at home with the parents, you know. And in those days, gas was, what, 25 cents a gallon? It was pretty nice, you know, hanging out at the Grandy Ballroom on the weekends, you know, party down.
Well, it's nice when you lived at home, so you could get along. You could still buy your little bag of weed and your dime bag and...
But Brian,
the West Coast Grow right now, the Detroit 420 show, eh? Anyway.
Let me just tell people that I did want to ask you to focus, but on this
this is coming from two ADD people.
Yeah, there was a radio station, an AM station, WDTW, wasn't that it?
Yeah,
1300 AM of, Brian had a show called the 420 show, which was all about growing and, what have you.
And medical marijuana.
Medical marijuana. But, give me your point so I can get some other people on the air though, Brian. What's up?
All right, then. No, I just wanted to say I think they should be making a reasonable living. I think everybody should make a good living in order to raise their family. Of course, it's the American dream, and the big corporations own the company. We know that they are the 1%, and we know that we are the 99%, and we are the majority. It's time that we speak up. It's time for the People's Party. It's time to vote third party. That's all I got to say. Have a good night. God bless.
That's plenty.
Thank you, Big B.
Thank you very much. Here is, let's see, here is Kevin. Kevin is in Wayne. Wayne, thanks for calling 2485.
Kevin, thanks for calling.
What did I say? Oh, I call him Wayne.
You did this last week.
it's getting towards the end of the show. I've been up since 7:30. 2485444WRIF. Kevin, hi, you're on the air.
Near Wayne Road. Yeah. So my name is Wayne.
Right.
Be very simple.
Yeah.
But, I mean, on the topic of the $15 an hour for the McDonald's employees and stuff like that, it would be nice, you know. I just think it's a little more complicated than, or simple. I don't know. It's just, I feel like if everybody made a living wage, that would be that would be great, but I don't think it's that simple because, I mean, it's just paper. So if you pass around all this paper, everybody gets $15. I mean, it's just going to make all the prices go up, and now everybody's going to want $30.
Well, you know, that is one of the consistent arguments against pay raises. In fact, like the Chamber of Commerce and people like that often say that, well, it won't matter. You know, the price of everything else will go up. It really doesn't because if there's enough competition, because the profit margin is so great in a lot of these industries that they can afford to absorb it. I mean, one of the things that people that were in unions knew is that they could negotiate. They would say, okay, we want $1 an hour more. Well, what did they really want? They wanted like 40 cents more. And the company would say, we'll go broke. We'll have to, you know, and finally, so it's a give and take. But one of the things that could be done, there could be some sort of assessment made on what particular industries or firms are capable of paying. Not so much the little guy that's, you know, got three employees, but these big corporations particularly, and, you know, even the ones that that franchise. And here's what I think. If people can't afford to pay somebody a living wage, why they shouldn't even be in business? I mean, maybe it works for them, but I mean, we wouldn't say, well, gee, you know, I can make my business, I can make $40,000 a year from it if I pay people $3 an hour. People would say, no, that doesn't work.
Well, or you just, you know, if you have a small business, you just work there, work your kids, you know, have your family. My friend owns a party store down on 9 Mile, and the only people who work there are he and his wife. That is it.
Yeah. There's actually a store up at 9 Mile in Coolidge where I go to Fine Wines, it's called. And these two brothers are often in there 14 hours a day, which is kind of nuts as well.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
Right.
True. All right, Kevin, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kevin. From Wayne.
Yeah. Here's Mount Clemens. No, it's Emily Kevin.
Oh, come on. He's silly.
Here's Dan from Mount Clemens. Dan, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
We're good.
That's good. Now, here's what I'm thinking about the minimum wage at $15. I agree with it. I totally agree that we need that. But so that we don't get it back to what it is now, I was thinking, how about like a graduated price freeze where if your business is doing real well, then we're going to freeze the prices so that they can't raise the price.
Sure.
But if you have a business that's not doing as well, then, okay, you can go up in your price only to the amount, you know, that it will, you know, help your business, but it won't hurt the people.
Sure, allow you to stay in business. I mean, there is sort of a natural inflation that that happens over time. I mean, we can, you know, I don't know if you ever, you probably all of us have been in restaurants, like there's Mario's restaurant downtown, and they have something from the, I don't know, probably the 1950s or 60s, I think, and it's like a filet is like $4.75, and it's probably like $30 now.
Old prices?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You can buy a Cadillac for $4,000, and now they're $40 at least, and all of that. But what really has to happen is some limit on return on investment. And whoa, that shakes up people. Because, I mean, how much is too much? And people, you know, who gives you the right to decide how much money a man should make? It's always a man anyway. There's got to be some social responsibility embedded in all these decisions. Should we really have people sleeping on the streets when someone else reels off a check for $148 million for a painting?
Right.
That doesn't sound right. I agree.
And there's an example of that.
I agree with who? With myself.
And I agree with me. Yeah. Aaron from Mount Clemens had sent us an email earlier in the week. And do you want to say?
Yeah, I want to say
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. You're doing some thinking there.
Yep.
This is an example of what you just said, Peter. You know, the email that we got from Aaron to Mount Clemens. He said he spoke to an older homeless man waiting to eat at a soup kitchen last month on one of those very cold days. This man said he has had 4 heart attacks and pneumonia 5 times so far this year, and they cut off his I'm not sure who they is, but he had his health care cut off. He couldn't get his inhaler and heart pills, which keep him alive. Why, Aaron continues to say, why would anything like this ever happen in this country? Is that homeless man any different than the billionaire corporate CEO? Of course not. But why is it that those that need the most get treated, I love this email, like they are subhuman, lazy, not contributing to society, etc.? People need to stop turning a blind eye, blaming the poor for wasting their tax dollars and milking the system. Things need to change, but he says it's sad to say it probably won't. Aaron, this is one of my favorite emails that we've ever received.
If you talk about people milking the system, it's
the 1%. Let's talk about the corporate fat cats.
Yeah.
They're all milking it good.
Let's take a break, and we come back. Chris from Sterling Heights, Dan from Warren, you guys are next.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
You hear the phrase a lot this time of year, Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays. But holidays are not always happy, particularly for guys grappling with a divorce they didn't choose. Suddenly these husbands and dads are thrust onto battlefields where the fate of everything they care about will be decided. In the meantime, many must await the outcome in someone else's home this holiday season. These men need more than the help of a good lawyer. They need the hope and encouragement of a good friend. Chances are I've described someone that you count among your friends. Be sure and remember him this season.
The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives, which includes protecting men's financial means to do so. Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. Offices in Troy, Novi, and now in Ann Arbor, 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
When endurance matters, Droid Max by Motorola is packed with up to 48 hours of battery life from a single charge, only from Verizon. Click the banner to learn more. 48-hour claim based on average user profile. Battery performance will vary based on network signal configuration and usage patterns.
I love giving great gifts. My family thinks I spend days picking out the perfect presents for them, but my secret is PersonalCreations.com. There are thousands of items for everyone on my list, from my mom to my brother, even my mother-in-law. Plus, I usually get a few things for myself and my home when I'm there, too. The imaginative decor is too cute to resist. The best part is the personalization on each item. Names, monograms, colors, they have so many options. Every item looks like it took forever to find and create, but it's as simple as a few clicks of the mouse. Here's the best part. Right now, Personal Creations has a special sale, up to 40% off hundreds of great gifts and festive decor. Trust me, you do not want to miss this deal. The only way to get up to 40% off hundreds of items is to go to PersonalCreations.com. Click the orange star in the top right corner and enter code RIBBON. That's PersonalCreations.com. Click the orange star, code RIBBON.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. This is our last segment, so if you'd like to have your opinion heard, please call in, 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743, and hard to believe that we are winding down the 43rd year of this program.
Wow, is that right?
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. We get this every so often. This is like a right-wing talking point. This is from Jack. He writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. 50 years of Democratic rule in Detroit, and it's whose fault? Why do you and your kind have no sense of honesty?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, but here.
That's funny.
How about if I kind of agreed with him just a little? It would have been great if we would have had a Republican in. I mean, really. You think I'm going to be sarcastic. If you go down to Grand Circus Park... I wonder if this guy didn't say where he's from. Probably.
I can't believe those words just came out of your mouth.
Yeah.
I'm still a bit stunned.
All right. If you go down to Grand Circus Park, there's a statue of a man sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
He was the mayor of Detroit, Hazen S. Pingree. We mentioned him last.
We did.
Get this. he was a businessman with no political experience. He was elected mayor in 1889, and he was Republican. And he was reelected in 1891, 93, 95, warning repeatedly against the dangers of government by corporations. He launched nationally visible crusades against Detroit's streetcar, gas, electric, and telephone companies. He successfully forced rate reductions that won him widespread popularity. He won public approval of citizen-owned electric light plant and became a national spokesman for municipal ownership and close regulation of utility and street railway.
Wow.
Let's see, I lost the... When the nationwide panic of 1893 caused a severe depression, Pingree gained support by opening empty lots to garden farming. People called him Potato Patch Pingree.
My gosh, he was ahead of his time there.
He was a Republican, had nothing to do with the Populist Party that had considerable support among, I don't know how that... But he's... where else? But...
he deserved that statue.
Yeah, he did. So that was... Yeah. So nitwits like this guy who thinks, well, it was the Democrats that caused this collapse. Does it occur to him at all that that something like deindustrialization may have had a little bit to do with it?
My gosh, yes.
Yeah, come on. But, yeah.
Let's be real.
All right. 1 o'clock, got a couple of great interviews. Angry white men. Listen up, dude. And also a show about sports. Why sports matter. All right, let's...
Can you give me like a little bit of a tease on why sports matter?
Well, this guy is defending sports. Matt Hearn, a former sports writer, he's defending sports from criticism that says it's just militaristic, violent, over-competitive, commercialized. And I don't know that... I don't know if he won the argument, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right, cool.
But not that I was arguing with him. But here's Chris in Sterling Heights. Chris, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
I'm doing pretty good. How are you guys?
Good.
Good, Chris.
All right, well, I'm just going to get right to my point about the whole minimum wages thing.
Yeah.
Because I know you got calls right after me, so I'll just get right to the point. But no, I honestly agree with it because I work at Toys R Us overnight building bikes. And honestly... Okay. Probably one of the easiest jobs I've ever had. And I get paid minimum wage. So, honestly, I think the minimum wage should go up for people flipping burgers or anything because it's easy. It's not that hard at all. And plus, while things are getting more expensive, you're going to have to make money.
Okay. Do you think being a DJ is hard?
Personally, no. I don't think it's really hard.
Okay.
But I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I sit on my ass... And I've got my Food Network on. I got my computer. I talk to listeners. I get paid a decent, fair living wage. And I feel I deserve it.
Well, everybody does,
Sorry,
as a couple
Neil.
Of people said. But think about this. Some people, you know, would make hundreds of thousands of years going, baby, baby. Yeah, we love Arthur. But, and one of the things that I would advise, Chris, because you have a very direct interest in this, a very personal interest, if you see, sometimes it's a little hard to hook into this stuff, if there's movements afoot, if there's public displays, protests, demonstrations, and what have you, and people are calling for a hike in the minimum wage, get with the program because it affects you and everyone else. And it doesn't have to do with how hard or, easy the job is.
Thank you for making that point.
Yeah, because what it's all about is not about whether flipping a burger or putting a bicycle together, but it has to do with that people that are working deserve to be compensated enough to have what we call a living wage. So,
it doesn't matter if you're... an iron worker or building bikes. Everyone deserves it.
Yeah, and the other thing is, one of the deals about wages is that the things that unions did was they raised the selling price of labor artificially. Whoa, what the hell is that all about? Here, whenever you hear like a conservative talking about the free market, that's going to be driving your wages down, driving down most people's wages. The reason that wages rose between the 1930s and the 1970s Well, they rose artificially because there was the first time a minimum wage law put in by the Democrats. And that unions that were finally supported by the Democrats, never well enough, to be sure. But they said, look, we have combined into a union of the workers, and if you don't pay us this amount, and if you don't give us overtime, and if you don't let us off on the weekend, and if we don't have an eight-hour day, we're going to strike. We're going to withhold our labor. And at first, beginning in the 1880s, as I was saying earlier, the bosses sent out federal troops and goon squads and the local police and the state militias and all of that to kill workers. I mean, there were slaughters of working people in, you know, they've been thrown out of their jobs. They were camping. They were forced into tents. The National Guard came and shot them all up even in the late 1930s.
Chicago, and this isn't the movies, folks.
The Chicago police just shot up a steel workers union picnic and killed, I can't remember how many people, 4, 5, 6 people, shot workers in the back,
yeah.
Stuff like that.
This is the kind of thing that happens in, South America.
Now, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was happening here, and that's what we're going back to. So what's the old thing? We either got to hang together or we're going to hang separately.
You got a million of
I got a million
those
of them.
Things.
Thank
I love
you.
Them all, Peter.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's Dan and Warren. Dan, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
Going good.
Yeah, I agree with minimum wage being raised, but not to $15 an hour.
How come?
If you're sitting at McDonald's at $15 an hour, what is giving you a drive to move forward to a better job?
Well,
what does that mean?
That minimum wage, like McDonald's and things like that, are supposed to be stepping stones for kids coming fresh out of high school to get into
the job. That's days gone by, my friend. Those are jobs that people who can't get other jobs are now, adults are working those jobs.
Older people are working.
I don't go to fast food restaurants, so I don't actually see it, but I ask people, what is the average worker that you saw when you went there today? And it is
people in their 50s
yeah.
are working that out. And, that everybody can't use it as a stepping stone. There is not places for everybody. Middle class people can't find jobs. Middle class people that got blown out of good paying jobs who are in their 50s can't find jobs. The millions and millions of people can't find jobs. So there's nowhere for them to go.
Okay, but $15 an hour is a little excessive. I'm apprenticing to be a plumber, and I'm only making $10 an hour.
Well, you know what?
Then you should be making more then.
Yeah, you should be.
And you will be making more once you're done apprenticing.
If you're, and this is a union job?
No, it's not. It's a non-union job.
And they're still an apprentice. Well, if you're in the plumber's union, you're...
Get in a union, my friend. Right?
Well, you can't just get in them, unfortunately. But you'd be making double that, probably, just as an apprentice or a journeyman. But
how do you get into it, then?
That's a whole other story.
Okay.
Point being that if somebody in fast foods, and Adam, who was an EMS in Detroit making $10 an hour, here's somebody, that I can't do without. You, for instance, as a plumber, when all of a sudden my pipes freeze in the middle of the winter, I got to call, I got to call you and say, hey, come on, you got to come out here and help me. You're an EMS guy, really important as well. Well, if a fast food worker makes $15 an hour, what does that do for Dan? I would say that would suggest a raise in your wages as well.
It would, but my viewpoint on that is if all the fast food restaurants disappeared, the world would continue spinning. Like, it would continue working just fine. If all the plumbers disappeared, who would you call to fix your pipes in your house? If all the builders disappeared,
well, sure.
Who would you call to fix your house?
Well, I always say, look on the other end of things. Who would you rather have disappear, the lawyers or the janitors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right, yeah, love plumbers. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Ben in Rochester. Ben, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
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 I'd like to talk about the minimum wage, and I think that it should be increased, but I think they should have, like, an age cutoff. Say, at, like, 25, there's a higher minimum wage based on, so businesses can choose between hiring uneducated kids versus hiring adults who have families to raise and bills to pay and whatnot.
Well, you know, one of the things this restaurant in Dearborn Heights, who we can't think of the name of, Click Cluck Cluck or something
it's
like that.
Cluck Cluck Moo.
Cluck Cluck Moo. Yeah. Cluck Cluck Moo. They pay their fast food workers $15 an hour, and one of the things they achieve is exactly what Henry Ford did 80 or 90 years ago when he began paying people $5 a day, which was an extraordinary wage then. And the reason that he wanted to do it was, I mean, people could not get used to the production line. And so, but $5 an hour kept him there. And one of the things that happens in the fast food industry is this, you know, enormous amount of turnover. And that would actually be, I mean, why does somebody have to have great ambition? I got to tell you. I never did and don't now have great ambition. A lot of stuff has fallen my way. Jillian and I have
I've had a few good breaks in my life.
Jillian and I have had national shows and what have you. I never went seeking it, never tried. I'm happy here
yeah,
at WRIF. I'm happy here at WRIF making, you know, just my little salary and what have you. I mean, other people I know, colleagues of ours, I mean, they eat, what's the whole three?
Eat, sleep,
and breathe. Talk radio, being a DJ, they want to have national prominence, and some of them do, that we know. And great. I mean, I have great respect for them. But
you have national. You have international
yeah.
prominence.
Well, because we broadcast to Windsor.
Yes.
But I'm sorry. I was just kind of raving there.
I'm a
small business owner, and and I think one of the biggest barriers for other people starting businesses is healthcare.
Sure.
And that these people who want a $50 minimum wage, oh, how much of that is going towards healthcare?
Well,
and that I think that I mean we need to get Medicare for everybody.
Sure.
We need
well,
to
thank
have a single payer system. And
ben,
I think Obamacare is a stepping stone.
Yes.
But, you know, it's not great. It kind of sucks. And you know, Obama, he hasn't really been that great. But I think that with a single-payer system, there isn't the fear of having to pay for the health care for an entire family just by hiring one person.
Well, I know. And I never understood why when Harry Truman, looking at the English system back in the late 1940s, didn't push harder for a national health program, and why General Motors didn't want it. Why would General Motors want to have to take on health care? Why would you know, any firm, if you could do what every single other country in the so-called rich country in the world, well, they did that. I didn't understand that. Like, what, if I may ask, what's your business?
Software development. I'm getting pulled over right now.
Uh-oh.
Are you really?
Yeah, I am. Maybe he's listening to the riff.
Oh, no.
Why don't you stop? Maybe we can get him on the air and say to give you a break. Is he pulling you over because you're talking on your cell phone while you're driving?
Yeah, I kind of drove into the middle lane. It's snowy out and it's hard to see the lines.
Oh, wow. No. Can we help you?
Is he walking up to the car?
Not yet. He's shining a light at me.
Oh. Oh my God.
Well, keep your hands in sight.
Tell him that Peter and Julian on the riff
yeah.
say hello, and we want to know
what?
If he is going to get Social Security.
What?
I can turn my volume up here.
Yeah, what,
oh God.
What,
this has never happened, I don't
yeah,
think.
Yeah, what city? What city are you in? Hey.
I am.
Hey, Ben. All right.
No, he's listening. Officer, he was doing good. He wants you to have a fair and living wage in Social Security.
And have your retirement protected as it should be under the Michigan Constitution. Did he?
Well, he's probably, the cop's probably like, you know what, I don't care about those jokers on the radio.
Yeah, or maybe they just.
But we support you, officer. He was just trying to.
Maybe they tased him or something.
Oh, well, get back to us, Ben.
Yeah, wow.
Let the guy go.
That was
Let
a
him
first.
Go.
That was
yeah,
a first.
That was.
All right, here's Stan and Taylor.
I feel kind of bad.
Yeah, me too. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to, I work for a Teamster company right now, and I just want to make you aware of some of the stuff that's going on. We got, like, the
I work for a company called YRC,
mm-hmm.
and they are making, you know, tons of money. And I took a pay cut of 15% like a few years ago, and they just want to reopen our contracts and extend it for another 5 years, and they want to start the new hires in some positions at $16 an hour. And this is like a Teamster company that, you know, see, I figured like Teamsters, like UAW should be something that should let people make a wage that's going to, you know, support a family.
Absolutely.
And, and I never heard anything like on any news or anything like when the UAW is going on, you know, wants them to take us. There's no news on this, and it's affecting like 34,000 families in the United States. And I just wanted, you know, I just want to really make you aware of that.
Well, actually, I am. And the idea that the UAW agreed to a two-tier wage system where some of the new hires are making $14 an hour. Think about that. The grandest of the grand American unions, the UAW, have workers starting at a wage less than the fast food workers are demanding. So, it's because, and this happens throughout American history, there's sometimes the ascendancy of capital, at the other time there's been the ascendancy of labor. And, guess who's winning, right now, Stan? Yeah. It's not good. But I think the tide is turning.
Well, yeah, you know, hopefully it will turn because, you know, I listen to your show a lot because I like the thinking behind, you know, how you're thinking about, you know, people should work, you know, as humans, we should all work together. You know,
sure,
and then,
yes.
You know, we're all greedy, but my God, we got to all have some heart. And it seems like these corporations are just tweaking us and.
Sure they are. But you know what? Let me just take a little issue with you. You know what? I'll bet you're not greedy. I bet you want just what's the best for yourself and your family and your community. And if you can do what, you know, that old phrase from the union movement, a fair day's work for a fair day's wage. And
give yourself some credit.
Yeah. So I don't think I doubt if you're greedy. And
and we talk to people. We know they're greedy.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the greedy people are the ones on top, because I don't know if you heard at the beginning of the show, I was talking that in the world, 300 men who make more than the bottom 3 billion people. I mean, how can you go to sleep at night with
on your conscience.
Yeah. I mean, guys that have like 30 stainless steel cars, for instance, you know, Jaguars and Cadillacs and stuff. Stuff like that that just can't even think about how to do it. Or the Walton family, as I said, could pay off the, you know, they're worth like $120 billion. They could pay off Detroit's debt and still have 5 people be worth over $20 billion,
yeah.
$1 billion.
Give an entire city a fresh start.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that feel good?
Yeah.
You would sure sleep good that night.
Yeah.
Although they probably take some kind of pill to go to sleep.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Stan, here's some good news, though. The guy that called in who got pulled over just got a warning.
Yay, Ben!
Ben just got a warning. All right, I'm almost
right
out of here, so thank you so much. What?
We just made a difference.
We did.
And a cop actually listened to us.
Yeah. That's great.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
So, Ben, next time pull over, then call us, or call us from home, because we don't want you to stop calling us. We like you.
Let's see if we can just get one real quick. Here is Tyler. Tyler, you got just about 60 seconds. Go ahead.
Hey. I want to join the debate.
Sure.
My outlook on this is these minimum wages is you get minimum wage because you have minimum experience, minimum education, and I think it's a problem if these people got paid a lot with no education, or even people that joined the UAW that didn't have a college education and just decided not to take that education, it's tough for me to be okay with like paying them that much. And then you say,
"Well, wait! You're not paying them. What, I mean, why wouldn't you just hope that everybody would get a good wage, a living wage? So, in other words, if $15 an hour is a living wage, you want people to work for what's a wage that's not a living wage? Come on.
I understand that, but But then, like you said, though, you said, oh, and the plumber's rate should go up. Well, the problem is, like, when people's wages go up, then prices go up. It's a never-ending cycle. Yeah?
Well, it is not a never-ending cycle, and that's one of the arguments. You got to be careful. Those are the arguments of, like, the Chamber of Commerce, the people that want to keep all of our wages low, because the lower our wages, the more money they make. There's got to be at some point, and you got to remember, there is, to some extent, a free market. So if all the wages go up in fast food markets, and all of a sudden they say, well, we got to start charging $7 for a hamburger, people won't go there. So what it means is the people that own things, the big corporations and all, are going to make less money. And good.
Wow. Do you think we can give Maurice one quick one? We got to go, Maurice.
Maurice, give us one shout out. We're late. Go ahead. What's up with Obamacare? Oh, I'm sorry.
You're going to have to do a program dedicated to Obamacare, and I still don't understand it.
Well,
yeah, who does?
That's it. All right.
There's the program.
We'll do it.
We're going to get to the bottom of it. We'll spend the week getting to the bottom of it.
Maurice, we do have to go. I want you, because you may be thinking that, because I know you drive cab, call us back next week at the beginning of the show.
Earlier.
And tell us, ask us the questions or whatever.
We'll give you the time you deserve, Maurice.
All right, Maurice.
As a dedicated listener to this program.
You have a great one. Bye-bye now. And Jefferson, thanks for fielding all those calls. Thanks all of you for listening and calling. And
Ben, we're so glad that you just got a warning.
Yeah.
It's my favorite story of the night.
And I hate to do it to some of you, but happy holidays. Hey, I got some great interviews ahead. Stay tuned for them.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Rib. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
Okay, I've got an amazing Christmas deal. Two words, Sherry's Berries. These gourmet berries are huge and freshly dipped in dark, white, and milk chocolatey deliciousness. Then they're covered in decadent toppings like chocolate chips and nuts. And get this right now, these mouthwatering gourmet berries start at $19.99. Plus, get double the berries for just $10 more. But you gotta hurry, Christmas is almost here, and this deal expires this Friday. The only way to get this amazing offer is to go to berries.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, and enter secret code GLITTER.
Business owners, do you want to double your sales in 12 months? Chet Holmes International's track record for the past three decades speaks for itself. Our legendary founder and best-selling author of The Ultimate Sales Machine, Chet Holmes, explains.
Why does one person open a business and you go back 30 years later and basically they've made themselves a job, not a business? Another person opens up a business and in 10 years they have 60 locations and cash out a multimillionaire. The difference between the two is not the product or the service, folks. It's the skills and learning curve of the entrepreneur.
We've created a serious training program. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months. And we'll give this to any serious business owner who calls 800-936-0222. Leave us a voicemail with your email to get this powerful audio training program at our expense. Call right now. It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 800-936-0222. That's 800-936-0222. From Chet Holmes International to your success.
WRIF HD1 Detroit.
The 12 Days of Rhythmus.
Brought to you in part by Weingarts. Everything from lawn to snow.
Keep listening for your next chance to win. Details online at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, if I said that anger played a large role in our culture, in our society, I don't think too many of you would dispute that. Think about the wars, hockey fights, just road rage, all of that. But how about if it had a very specific component, something we could talk about today? Angry white men. Yeah, I think, well, probably that's a lot of you out there. There's a book that I think is extraordinarily interesting and challenging to our concept of our society and ourselves if you're a white guy like I am. The book is called Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. That sounds kind of even a little threatening, doesn't it? End of an era. Michael Kimmel is the author, and he's a distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University in New York. He's the executive director at the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. That's us, guys. He's an author or editor of more than 20 books, and they include things like Manhood in America, The Gendered Society, The History of Men, and Guyland. And we're reaching him at his office in New York City. Michael Kimmel, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Nice to be here, Peter.
Hey, you know, one could say, why this identification of race? As we go through our life, I sure see a lot of angry white guys. I see a lot of angry black guys as well. Why not just angry men?
I really wanted to talk specifically about guys who see race and gender as a part of why they're so angry. So I wanted to capture those guys who are, you know, sort of really upset and angry about affirmative action, for example, or, you know, and I thought that they identify as white men. And also, I wanted to identify, for example, all the Rampage school shooters, all but one of whom is a white boy. I wanted to bring race into the conversation because very often we don't talk about it. And I think that that's a really, that's sort of the grounding of what I wanted to talk about in this book, is that men who are angry often are led to see the causes of their anger in gender or race terms.
Now, how does that get posed for them? I mean, we certainly see that on a lot of the right-wing talk shows that I would say pander to those kind of emotions, and people
right.
that are confused about the future, uncertain about the present. But where does this information come as to identify the cause of who we're going to call the angry white man? Maybe we'll even call it like they used to be the average white band, and it was the AWB. This is AWN, the angry white man. How is their anger framed? I mean, who suggests the target?
Well, there's a lot of men who are angry at a whole variety of things. And many of them are also, many white men are simply confused and kind of bewildered by the rapidity of the changes that have happened in our lifetimes. I mean, you know, and so part of what I talk about as the end of the era is it's the end of an era of assumed, taken for granted men's entitlement to positions of power and prestige and economic success. That's the end of that era. You can't assume it anymore. But it also means that we're going to be bumping up against exactly that entitlement. Let me tell you one story,
sure.
for example, that first gave me the idea that something's up here, then I have to actually start thinking about it. I was on a talk show. This is going to crystallize, I think, some of the reasons why I want to talk about race and gender and not just about, you know, class and economic changes. I was on a talk show about some years ago, and I was opposite four of these angry white men. And these were four nice corporate guys. They had corporate jobs, and they were passed over for promotions, or they didn't get jobs, and they were really, really angry about it. They believed that reverse discrimination was what they had experienced. It's also known as affirmative action. But they believed they were qualified for jobs, qualified for promotions. They didn't get them, and they were really angry about it. And so the reason I'm telling you this story is because the title of this particular show was a quote from one of these men. And the quote was, "A black woman stole my job."
Huh.
So they told their stories, and then so then it was my turn to speak. And I had just one question for these guys. I said, and it was actually about the title, "A Black Woman Stole My Job." And it was really, my question was really about one word in the title. It was about the word "my."
Mm-hmm.
I asked these guys where they got the idea it was their job. Why isn't the title of the show "A Black Woman Got the Job" or "A Black Woman Got a Job"? Because that's what men's entitlement, white men's sense of entitlement, sounds like. That was my job. It was stolen from me. I'm the injured party here. Now, why then do I call it angry white men? Because these men spoke through a position of race and gender to understand what had happened to them. A black woman stole my job. So for me, that was my first inkling. Wow, there's something going on here with that idea of entitlement. I've got to sort of think about that. I've got to figure that out. And that's what led me to interview all of the different groups of men that I did for this book, which is kind of a tour among different types of angry white men.
Well, reintroduce you. Michael Kimmel is my guest. He is a professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University in New York. His book is Angry White Men, American masculinity at the end of an era. And I was watching, you think, where am I going, how am I going to bring this in? I was watching the Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Birds, and Tippi Hedren is talking to the leading man, and she said, I have a job. And he said, you have a job? And laughed. So, so you go back, when was that, like early 60s, 50 years ago or so, and it was unusual for women and people of color to compete in the marketplace for the jobs that existed above service jobs and outside of the home and what have you. And there was discrimination. They couldn't get jobs, and the system discriminated. So now there is some truth to that, that sometimes with affirmative action, and there's been lawsuits about that, that we wanted to level the playing field. So there is this actual sense that that this isn't meritocracy, but this is discrimination, whereas sure. That's what started it in the first place.
Right. I mean, so we grew up thinking that that the old system was a level playing field. And now, of course, what has happened is that women and people of color and other groups that were had been marginalized and who had experienced that discrimination said, you thought that was level? We've been trying to run uphill with the wind in our face the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've been gliding. and so they really, you know, so that I think really did expose it. We grew up, and this is, I think, the reason why so many of these men are sort of angry is I think that the real emotion underneath the anger is more about confusion, bewilderment. Like, we grew up, as you just said, in that Hitchcock movie, we grew up thinking that the workplace was going to look like the Don Draper and Mad Men, you know?
Sure.
Like, all the men would have the offices on the outside with the windows, and all the women would be gathered in the center in like a corral of secretaries, and you could basically have your pick of any one of them. And having sex with secretaries was kind of like a perk of office life. Well, of course, that world is completely gone now, and it's happened so fast and so dramatically that the workplace looks nothing like that anymore. And so part of the time we watch that kind of a TV show, and we think, oh, you know, like, look at what it used to be like then. We're so much more advanced now. They're drinking hard alcohol, you know, in their office in the morning. They're smoking in the elevator. We're so much more advanced. And then there's another part of us that goes, yeah, but it was so much more simpler then, and it was so much more, you know, it was so much more welcoming to us men.
Well,
so
yeah, as you say, the subtitle of your book, Angry White Man, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. There's always confusion at the end of an era.
I mean, right. I mean, things have changed so fast and so dramatically. You know, the idea, for example, that we're sitting on the verge of a national change in which, you know, we will have in the next 10 or 15 years same-sex marriage in every state. It's just a demographic reality. I mean, 75% of people under 30 support it. It's just a done deal.
Yes. Hey, I should have asked you this before we went on the air. Do you happen to have your book at hand?
I do.
Okay. Okay, well, usually I don't have people read from nonfiction, but if you go to page 276, there's a subhead there, What's Right About Being White, and you incredibly say, and you're going to have to explain this one, the white supremacists, and you're talking about a specific small group of very, very angry white men who are at least half right. Could you read just that paragraph? Because I think that sums up so much, and I love that phrase about the wrong address. But do you have that?
Yes, of course.
Starting with
the white supremacists are at least half right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. The white supremacists are at least half right. They have been forgotten in the rush to the global marketplace. They may have some legitimate gripes, though they're delivering their mail to the wrong address. The right address, of course, is neoliberal economic policy. It hasn't been black people who have foreclosed on their farms, or feminist women who have outsourced their jobs and closed the factories, or gay people who have sunk their mortgages underwater, or immigrants who opened the big box store with the massive tax breaks and spectacular local government incentives that forced them to close the small hardware store that their family had been operating for generations. The combination of aggrieved entitlement and their misdirected rage has led to their sporadic outbursts, clandestine terrorist conspiracy, and paranoid political thinking.
You could almost, and well, I should say, too, that's from Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, Michael Kimmel, my guest and the author. Yeah, go ahead. Well, one of the things I wanted to just...
Stand on that for a second, though.
But,
okay?
Michael, do this for me first.
Sure.
Most people, when they hear the word liberal, they think of the Democratic Party, of liberals. Explain
yes.
Neoliberal economic policy. That's,
okay.
Yeah.
When I say neoliberal economic policy, I'm talking about the economic policies of all of the, quote, when I say neoliberal, it means the penetration of market criteria into all aspects of social and economic life, so that everything is market-based, and you have this, the expansion of a kind of the global marketplace, and global workforces being mobilized in all kinds of other countries with different kind of labor laws, and everybody coming under the same kind of economic regime. That's what I mean. I mean the G20 is neoliberalism.
Sure. Okay.
I don't mean liberal as in liberal leftist. But here's the thing about the white supremacists that they get right. Okay, and then I'll tell you what they get wrong.
Okay.
What
good.
They get right is they have been badly done by. They have been outsourced and downsized and laid off and foreclosed and they've had to close the store. They're the ones who have had to do that, and they're furious. They're downwardly mobile. Now, when you're furious and downwardly mobile, it seems to me you have two options for how to deal with this. You can go, you can see what happened to you in race and gender terms, a black woman stole my job, and you'll move to the right. If you see what happened to you in class terms, you can move to the left. There's, the same thing is, so the heroes of the extreme right wing, some of the further the militia of Michigan, some of the Tea Party activists, that they see things as something happened to you. They stole, the government stole what was yours, gave it to all these other undeserving other people. But just at the same outlook could be taken to the left in the words of, say, Tom Joad in John Steinbeck's great novel The Grapes of Wrath, or Bruce Springsteen. it's so interesting to me that you have, in Michigan, for example, Bruce Springsteen has an amazing fan base among white working class men.
Sure.
Right? Amazing, because he is the poet laureate of the American white working class. And he is a committed leftist.
Yes, he is. He is indeed.
So if you see what happened to you in class terms, you'll move to the left. If you see what happened to you in race and gender terms, you move to the right. So I'm saying they're half right. What happened to them was bad. What's wrong is they're delivering their mail to the wrong address. It wasn't women or gay men or immigrants or black people who did the things that did them in. In fact, so in a way, this is a kind of Thomas Frank, what's the matter with Kansas thing. They've been seduced into a misunderstanding of what actually has happened to them.
Now, isn't there, I'm talking to somebody who is a professor of sociology, so permit me if you will, but a factor of a psychological structure. In other words, if you people that are authoritarian personalities that are used to being in a hierarchy, they can't deal with criticism of the figures above them. They're actually psychoanalytic chicken poops, if you can. Yeah. So they look, to who's beneath them historically as the root of their cause, or it's the Stockholm syndrome. They so identify with their captors that they don't have the nerve to change anywhere. So, why do people choose? I mean, the left alternatives there, the right alternatives there. I mean, why some men, for their anger, and people go right, others go left?
Good question, Peter. And this is part of the answer to the larger question that you asked me. How come they start becoming angry in this way? And one of the things that I found is that a lot of the emotions that they feel that a lot of these men who I interviewed. Now, remember, I'm talking about men's rights groups, father rights groups, talking about neo-Nazis and white nationalists and white supremacists. These guys that I interviewed, who are, the angry white men, These guys have a wide range of emotions. What happens to them is that their emotions are massaged and manipulated to become the kind of politicized rage that you see, for example, when they become angry white men. For example, one of the things that happens in that I talk about in the book is a guy who calls up Rush Limbaugh, who is, you know, the patron saint of angry white men, right?
Sure.
And everybody else on the radio dial who's involved in outrage radio basically just tries to outdo Rush. So this guy calls up Rush Limbaugh and he says, "I'm really upset. I lost my job. I could lose my house because I can't make the rent. My kids are miserable. You know, I'm really upset, Rush. I'm really, you know," and he's expressing what I read and I hear on the radio as anguish, confusion. And Rush says, "You don't sound upset. You sound angry." And then he manipulates that anguish into, "You should be angry at them and them and them. And join us because we're all angry at them." So clearly, I mean, the Tea Party is another great example. There are a lot of people who are really angry, but this is not funded. The Tea Party is not funded by grassroots people kicking in $5. This is funded by billionaires who are really interested in manipulating that anger and directing it toward particular targets.
Do you think it's fair?
And by the way, the particular targets are not them.
Yes. Michael Kimmel, do you think it's fair to lump in terms of a range of anger men in the Tea Party movement and Ku Klux Klanners? It seems there's at least a range of anger and understanding. I mean, I would say there's more that the Tea Party criticizes that makes sense than certainly anybody in the Ku Klux Klan.
Absolutely. Look, I am not saying that these groups are equated in any particular way or that they all line up on the political spectrum in the same particular way. Absolutely not. In fact, one of the things that I write about in the book is, you know, the men's rights and father rights groups, many of those guys would probably vote Democratic. It's not a matter that they're all politically aligned. It is that these are each one of these groups is an expression of this kind of anger that I specifically want to talk about through the prisms of race and gender.
Tell me, when you talked about interviewing people, how did the structure of this book, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, I don't think I've said, by the way, that you can go to nationbooks.org and find Michael Kimmel's book, and there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Tell me about the structure of the book and how much field work was there?
Well, you know, some of the field work, I had thought that much of the field work was actually going to take place in my study on the computer, because there's a lot of websites that I could go to, a lot of chat rooms. I figured that would be just fine. But then I started going to chat rooms, and I realized pretty soon that I needed to go talk to some of these guys. And so I actually went out and, you know, interviewed about 40 or 50 guys who are on the extreme right. I interviewed some men's rights activists, some father rights activists. So that's basically, I was out in the field interviewing, and I probably interviewed a total of about 100 men for this book.
What was your feeling about them? Did you think probably they were just going to, you know, sort of approaching them one-dimensionally, angry white men that has only one characteristic to it? But after you talked to them, probably realizing guys had been screwed by family court decisions and what have you, and couldn't get to see their kids and all. Did you get more of a three-dimensional view of them?
I did. I have to say that probably when I began the book, I felt more angry at them than I did at the end of the book.
Okay.
I think readers would see. I'm actually somewhat empathic. I don't agree with their analysis of their situation. I don't agree that the targets of their anger are the right targets. But I do share, in some cases, their anguish. I do share their feelings of, you know, being confused and hurt. What I was saying, perhaps most you know, importantly, is I feel that the only way to engage with these men is with compassion, because they, I couldn't tell you, Peter, well, you know, you may be angry, but, you know, your feelings are wrong. Your feelings are real, but they may not be true. That is to say, your feelings are real, you have them, but when I say true, they may not be an accurate analysis of your situation. The things that are actually causing you pain may not be the things that you think are causing you pain.
You worry, I'm sorry, finish.
No, please. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, do you worry at all that this could be interpreted as all those conservative and right-wing guys? Just so angry, and all us liberal kind of lefty guys, we are mellow and getting in touch with our Buddha center and all that. You know, I mean,
good grief, I hope not. First of all, because, I mean, I don't know about you, but the numbers just aren't there. But secondly, why would they be mobilizing that kind of anger rather than ministering to it? Why would the conservative Republican Party, wing of the party, for example, not be absolutely rallying for veterans' benefits? These are the guys, the soldiers, who fought the wars that these Republicans wanted us to fight. Why aren't they supporting them now? I mean, to me, they are abandoning the very people that they say that that are the backbone of their support.
Well, I think, as usual, particularly them, but a lot of political parties, think about the next election. And I guess that's what that's a strategy.
You know what? I think it's even more limited than that. I don't think they're thinking of the next election. I think they're thinking of my next election. Like, how do I get reelected? You know, the heck with the party stuff. The heck, just how do I get back into power?
Well, Michael Kimmel, I want to thank you for a great conversation. The book is Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. And Michael Kimmel, a distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University in New York. The book is published by Nation Books. You can go to nationbooks.org, and there'll be a link directly to the book on my website, peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Michael Kimmel, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you, Peter. It's a lot of fun.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call.
I love giving great gifts. My family thinks I spend days picking out their perfect presents. But my secret is PersonalCreations.com. There are thousands of items for everyone on my list, and all are personalized with names, monograms, and more. Right now, Personal Creations has up to 40% off hundreds of gifts. The only way to get up to 40% off the best gifts is to go to PersonalCreations.com. Click the orange star in the top right corner and enter code GLITTER.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez-Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
101 WRIF, locking in everything that rocks.
Now maybe, did I mean to treat you bad? Yeah, but I did anyway. Now maybe, some say your life was saved. Yeah, but you lived it anyway. And so maybe, your friends will stand around you, watch you crumble as you fall to the ground. And then someday, your friends will stand beside as you were flying. Oh, you were flying off so high. But then someday people look at you, the world they call their own, they watch you suffer. Yeah, here you're going home. And then someday we can take our time to brush the leaves aside.
your hat.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I don't think there's too many people that don't either play or watch sports. I mean, talk about the national pastime. I mean, we used to say it was baseball. Now it's just a whole wide range of sports that we fanatically watch, particularly, you know, root for the home team. And we've got some great teams here in Detroit. Even imagine Detroit Lions doing some stuff, which is totally amazing. The spectator sports and professional sports, though, and to some extent, sports in general, have a dark side as well. Overly competitive, we're told, very militaristic, cruel at times. And so we kind of park that aside. Although sometimes, like hockey, we love it, right? I don't, but whatever. A very interesting book addressing a lot of this has come my way. It's called One Game at a Time, Why Sports Matter. Does it need a defense? Most of us think sports do matter, at least in our personal lives, and it's certainly on one of the greater media stations that we're broadcasting to. The author is Matt Hearn, and Matt Hearn lives and works in East Vancouver. He founded something called the Purple Thistle Center, also Car Free Vancouver Day. He's a former sports writer and a radical urbanist whose writing has been published across the world and in 10 languages. He's written Common Ground in a Liquid City, and I want to welcome him. We're reaching him in his office in Vancouver. Matt Hearn, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks a lot for having me, Peter.
Just in that description, there's about 20 things I want to ask you. You're a former sports writer. Looks like you're still doing it.
That is true to a certain extent. To say that I'm a former sports writer is true. I covered the Grizzlies and I covered the NBA for about 8 years until our sadly lost basketball team here went to Memphis. But now I just kind of claim to be a sports writer, so that means I get to watch sports and call it research, you know.
Okay. And what does it mean to be a radical urbanist? Most people, I don't even know what they would, an urbanist, someone who hangs out in the city. What's a radical urbanist?
Well, I like to, my doctorate is in urban studies, and I like to think about making and remaking the city in new and different ways so that the city can actually become a place for citizens to inhabit rather than just a place that is planned and organized for them by master planners and experts.
And in Vancouver, you created, pardon me, a car-free day. I wonder how that would go over in Detroit. Not so much that we're still formally called the Motor City, but yet all what we would need to be car-free just doesn't exist.
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually as you're recounting my bio there. I was thinking, oh, maybe just leave that out for the Detroit audience there, would you? We just founded a giant festival here in Vancouver for one day where a whole bunch of city streets get taken over for people playing sports in them, people playing music, and kids running around in streets. I'm interested in the effect that cars have on the urban landscape and ways to rethink about urban mobility. So, and that's just one exercise, one annual intervention into rethinking the way we use city streets.
You know, I think most people, when they watch professional sports or college ball or whatever, simply are immersed in the game. A lot of the times, just the quality of the game. Sometimes it's not even rooting for the home team. You could be watching teams from other states and still appreciate the quality of play. And for people with a left or liberal or progressive consciousness, you know, at least with me, you have to park some feelings aside. I think most people don't. They're just the game, period. But us lefties always got, four other agendas going. And so I want to kind of forget what I was calling in the introduction, the dark side of sports. And as I said, that a lot of that can be, you know, violence, sexism, homophobia, this hyper-consumption that you talk about in your book, One Game at a Time. So, Matt Hearn, in a lot of ways, this is a defense of sports, right?
Absolutely and unabashedly a defense of sports. And I think it's kind of a book that I've been meaning to write since I was about 13 years old. Because I've always played sports. I've always been an athlete. And I've always been a huge sports fan as well. I always love watching sports. I like watching sports in person, and I like watching sports on television. And as I kind of grew, I noticed that I attracted a certain amount of scorn from sophisticated types, intellectuals of every single, you know, across the ideological spectrum, kind of, you know, sophisticated thinking people, people that had presumably kind of, you know, cultural scope to their ideas, kind of heaped scorn on me and my fellow athletes and people that, you know, that enjoyed sports, enjoyed spectating sports. And the and I think this is fairly common for so many of us that like sports, that we that there's something about it that we should be slightly ashamed of. And Noam Chomsky said this one time once, and he, you know, and he's kind of like a godfather of the American left, and I respect him in all kinds of ways. But he said this thing one time. He said he was listening to sports talk radio, and he was amazed at the level and depth of conversation that people were having. And he thought that if people just stopped caring about and talking and thinking about sports so much and put all that attention towards something that really matters, we'd live in a lot better country. And I think that's a fairly common sentiment from a lot of kind of, you know, sophisticated intellectual and particularly progressive, you know, leftist folks. And I think that's tremendously obnoxious and condescending.
Yeah, it's sort of like the old opiate of the masses, right?
That exactly. And I think that that analysis is held to fairly staunchly by a lot of folks. And I was thinking as you said it, I was thinking, you know, would he say that about music, say, or about theater, or about literature? Would anybody say, I really wish people would stop thinking about music and, you know, and pay attention to what really matters? And I think it's the answer to that is obviously not, because music is what matters. Music is one of the essential components of what makes life worth living. And I think sports qualifies that as well.
Well, yeah.
I want to talk, I'm sorry, just to finish that thought
sure.
there. I want to think about sports as part of a creative continuum. I think for myself personally, there's no place in my life where I feel more creative than when I have a basketball in my hand, for example. And I think that we need to think about sports as on a continuum. I do not think sports are art. Those are not commensurate things. But I do think that they are, sports constitute creative activity, and that we should consider with the same kind of respect and care that we do of, you know, larger, more, you know, what are typically considered more sophisticated, you know, arts.
Well, oftentimes watching sports or sometimes even playing is characterized as being mindless. And to some extent, if you think of the Buddhist concept of that, that's exactly what I like. The main sport that I play is handball. And I love it that I'm not thinking about a thing. In fact, if you start thinking, oh, I'm going to hit it there, I'm going to hit you like that, you got a good chance you're going to miss it. The best thought in that is no thought. Just reflexively do what has to be done. And the same thing with watching sports. I mean, do you really want to watch, you know, films about the Holocaust all the time? or see what a rat the other side of the political spectrum is? I don't. I want some time down from, you know, the kind of intellectual processes that haunt my brain all the time.
Right. Well, you know, and I think that is certainly true. There certainly is an entertainment value to watching sports. And I think just to talk just for a second about spectating, you know, oftentimes over the years I've run into analyses, again, particularly from kind of sanctimonious leftists, who say, you know, well, okay, if you play sports, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But watching sports, that's mindless and passive and consumptive. And my response to that is, would anybody say that, again, about music? Would anybody say, well, playing music is okay, but listening to it is passive and consumptive?
Sure, like going to a Bruce Springsteen concert.
Totally, or it's okay to be an actor, but, you know, but going to a play, that's, you know, passive and consumptive. And I'd be like, that's absurd. I think that that spectating and playing are on a spectrum of experience, and there's a nexus of relationship around appreciating, you know, creative activity. And some of it involves participating, and some of it means that, you know, critically admiring other people's activities.
Sure.
And I think that it's while yes, it is true that I really like the thing you said about mindfulness, you know, and sort of mindlessness at some point, because for much of it, you know, for much of me, my activity now, you know, engagement with sports is entirely meditative. It's, you know, it's actually a place where I actually finally can breathe and think actually clearly. But one of my arguments is that the progressive kind of liberal left has so long condescended to sports, has thought of sports as something for kind of, you know, lower thinking kind of barbarians, that most of the left, broadly speaking, has abandoned the sporting world as a place where legitimate politics can happen, and allowed some of the worst aspects of our culture, the most regrettable politics, the most militaristic, the most sexist, the most violent, the most homophobic kind of politics to rush in and take over a lot of the sporting world. And my argument is that if we really thought that sports mattered, if we took sports seriously, and we didn't condescend to athletes, we didn't condescend to sports fans, we didn't condescend to the sporting world, then we could think of it as a place where politics actually did intrude and really did matter. And that, and I don't mean big politics. Well, I do mean big politics. I do mean big politics in the sense of, you know, what do we think of the Washington Redskins logo? But I also mean in everyday politics around teamwork, around taking care of each other, around trust, around mutuality. Those are everyday kinds of politics that are played out in on fields and rinks and gyms every day all over the world that I think are really, really important, and we should pay them due respect.
Matt Hearn is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. His book is One Game at a Time, Why Sports Matter. It's published by AK Press, and you can go to akpress.org. Also to Mighty Mac Hearn, that's H-E-R-N, mightymachearn.com, and you can link up with this. But you can buy it through AK Press, a wonderful publisher. And you can also go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and I'll have a link to both of those on there. Well, let's go back to how the left and liberals often view sports. There's two aspects to it, I would say. One, I think you named, that it seems to be a repository of values that people on the left don't like. Very aggressiveness, violence, sexism, homophobia, and as you said, hyper-consumption, all of that. Also, there's the idea, and this was big, oh, I don't know, maybe 30 years ago or so, the non-competitive games. They didn't want anybody to feel badly because they lost. I mean, I just lost an important handball game, 21-20. And I don't even want to tell you who missed the important shot. It would be too embarrassing. But it was an incredible game. You know, somebody had to win and somebody had to lose. So maybe address that. Competitiveness, one of the things, I mean, you see when you're playing sports, you see people get mad, people, you know, leaving the bench, huge brawl, getting angry and all of that. And that's not the values that are put forth by the left. We think of that as being put forth by the right, aggressiveness, militarism, what have you.
And I think that that is worthy of continuing an ongoing conversation. Like, when I think of where do I hear arguments and conversations around, say, you know, violence or aggressiveness or domination, the most fecund and the most kind of interesting arguments that I know of are often around the sporting world. Think of, for example, Richie Incognito kind of conversations right now. Sure. What does it mean to be bullied? What does it mean to be, you know, to be violent? In Canada, conversations around fighting and hockey, for example, are incredibly kind of thoughtful and sophisticated and passionate. And I think that part of that is, and sure that many sports are imbued with typically, you know, right-wing kind of values. But I think they're also imbued with values that kind of are historically incredibly important to the larger left, ideas like solidarity, ideas like community, ideas like mutual aid and support. Those are deeply imbued, not just in team sports, but in individual sports.
I guess I don't understand.
Sorry, just to,
yeah, finish. Go ahead.
Sorry. Just to talk about competition a little bit, and I think there's lots of room for conversation about the idea of competition, because sometimes when we're competing, it feels lousy. You know, it feels like we got dominated. It feels low. It feels like people would do anything to win. People would cheat. People would take advantage of you. And that kind of competition, and we've all experienced it, that feels lousy. Nobody likes to be part of that. That's like a dog-eat-dog kind of dystopic version of sports. But there's also the versions of sports that all of us are also familiar with and have encountered, where you play a game hard, you play a game incredibly aggressively, you play a game, you know, you bash up against each other playing basketball. At the end of the game, you know, or halfway through the game, you stop and you don't even know what the score is. Or at the end of the game, you've had an incredibly hard-fought game, and whether you've won or lost, it doesn't matter. The fact of competition has pushed each of you to a different place and a different level of intensity. And I find that oftentimes people who aren't particularly acquainted with sports find it often sort of, you know, dissonant. And I see it, for example, because I've, you know, been involved in boxing and boxed for a long time. Shout out to Tommy Hearns there, the Motor City Cobra. That you see, for example, two people boxing, and they're boxing, trying to punch each other in the head for 10 rounds. And the final bell rings, and what do people do? inevitably boxers fall into each other's arms and hug each other and check to see if they're okay. And that happens, there's a level of trust, that a level of care, and I dare I say a level of solidarity that is imbued in that kind of competitive environment that all of us have encountered who play sports. We all know what that feels like, and it's a kind of a level of closeness and a level of care for each other that's very hard to replicate in other parts of our lives.
You know, Matt Hearn, in your second chapter, you talk about boxing and also about mixed martial arts. And I was thinking that, I want to speak straight to you, of course, is that I find men fighting really boring. I mean, well, there go the guys against, whether it's on a hockey rink or, you know, the bench clearing and all that. And mixed martial art with, you know, seems to me to be sort of all, you know, you use that phrase, almost a barbarism. And I know, I see those guys, and I see after, you know, they've just been beating the crap out of each other, and then they're hugging. It just seems like a weird activity. You get hurt playing handball or baseball or stuff like that, but not because your opponent is smacking you in the face or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and I guess one of my arguments that I've been talking about, you know, as I kind of talk about this book and I've, you know, been lecturing and thinking about it with friends and, you know, in bars and kind of lecture halls and, you know, all over the place is that I don't think I can ask, no, I know I can't ask anybody to like sports. That's an aesthetic choice. And I can't ask anybody to like, say, boxing or mixed martial arts as I do. But what I'm asking folks to do is to care and respect about the possibilities there. And people have always fought. And people have always fought for other people's entertainment. And I'm not asking you to like it, because many people, perhaps yourself included, find it kind of gross, kind of like weird, kind of scary, kind of damaging, kind of, you know, just unsettling. And I feel those same emotions too, especially when you see someone get knocked out or badly hurt or something. You think, oh, Lord. On the other hand, there is something that imbues a certain kind of trust, a certain kind of togetherness that is very hard to replicate, and a certain kind of intensity of emotion. And as a longtime boxing fan, I'm troubled by people who get hurt, and I'm troubled particularly by concussions. On the other hand, that I practiced, practiced some martial arts and practiced some jiu-jitsu in particular, and there's a level of trust and a level of companionship that you feel with people that you're practicing with. Even when you're just sparring, for example, doing jiu-jitsu, there's an incredible amount of trust you have in your partner, your opponent, because your opponent could very easily hurt or even maim you. And so there's a level of kind of closeness that is created in kind of combat sports that's really hard to replicate. And it's a really intense experience that I value, and, you know, many other people value tremendously. I don't box anymore because I'm too old and fragile, but I miss it tremendously.
Well, you take up handball. I play with guys that are sometimes in their late 70s. You know, they're creaking along the court. The book is One Game at a Time, Why Sports Matter. Matt Hearn is my guest, the author, and it's available from AK Press, akpress.org. You can also go to mightymatthearn.com. And my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. You mentioned concussion, and I was, you know, so much of that has been in the press lately about professional football players and the short lifespan of their career and how so many of them wind up without much money and with severe injuries. Where in the world is that going, that the conversation? And is there anything that can be done to limit the damage that's being done?
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. And it's not just, I mean, it's football for sure because of the tremendous amount of head trauma that football players encounter, but it's also in hockey. A huge amount of kind of damage being done to retired hockey players, and you see the trauma that they go through. And when we're talking about concussions, we're not just talking about, you know, feeling a little sick or, you know, something that goes away in a few days. We're talking about things that maim people's lives for the remainder of their days, and it's super troubling. You know, people like Andre Waters and Dave Duerson and Mike Webster and Junior Seau and uncounted others who are living, you know, and you read stories about Tony Dorsett, and it's heart-wrenching. It really is. And I think that, you know, we need an ongoing and sophisticated and really honest discussion about head injuries. And it's something that I frankly have been far too blithe about over my kind of sporting career and have suffered a whole whack of concussions myself. And I'm worried about it. I'm worried about what happens like everybody else is. And I surely didn't play professional football.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think one of the kind of issues that we're facing is that many of our sports and the kind of rules around them were conceived at a time when people were a lot smaller,
yeah.
didn't train year round, didn't have this kind of incredibly sophisticated fitness regimens that lead to players now being these, you know, essentially just giants running into each other. And I can't conceive of a time, you know, when football is not an integral part of North American culture, but that doesn't mean it's not going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it should happen. Maybe there should be some really, you know, very fundamental rethinking about the damage that we're, you know, that young men are inflicting upon themselves for our entertainment.
Yep. Well, one of the things, and as we just have a few minutes left, we were talking about the dark side of professional sports, but also a lot of times high school and college as well, particularly like violence and sexism and homophobia. But that's being addressed in a way that I don't think it ever has been previously. I mean, when I think about how quick some of these teams have been to move against the utterances or what they've discovered, right? So, I mean, do you think that the worst aspect of sports, the part that we don't like and isn't good for either the sport or for our general culture, is it beginning to catch up with the rest of the country?
You know,
I
think it is, and I think, you know, and this is not, well, first is to acknowledge that, you know, it's rightfully true that people acknowledge and think about sports teams, about locker rooms, about sports culture as, you know, as oftentimes horrifically homophobic, as horrifically sexist, and full of the kind of, you know, Rich Incognito, Jonathan Martin kinds of relationships, whether it's a, you know, a local club team or whether it's a school, you know, high school team or whether it's a, you know, semi-pro or high performance or a pro team, that, you know, many people think of those kind of locker rooms and sports culture as being like essentially full of kind of gross retrograde attitudes. And that is true in lots of times. But the opposite is also true. The sports teams are, and sports locker rooms and sports environments are also full of care and trust. And that I think that the arguments and the conversations around Richie Incognito, the conversations around Jason Collins, the conversations around the You Can Play Foundation, this was founded by Brian Burke, to thinking about sexuality, to thinking about bullying, to thinking about gender, those conversations are alive and well in many sports arenas. And part of my argument in the book is that because inherently, what we do when we play sports and when we watch sports is to think about people's bodies and their capabilities. We're thinking very closely about our own bodies. We're thinking very closely about other people's bodies and what they can and can't do. And so that, and that kind of with a cross-sectional kind of analysis that also runs through sports around fairness. Sports folks are inevitably kind of interested in fairness and justice, about how you can make games, you know, fair and equal. And that the idea of discriminating, the idea of prejudicial attitudes towards people simply because of the kind of body and the things that they can do with their bodies is oftentimes abhorrent to sports folks. So the idea that, you know, that a queer kid can't play just because they're queer or that somehow should be excluded from sports environments is abhorrent, not just to everyday folks, but to many of the sports folks in a very particular kind of way. And that the idea that sports could actually become a force for good in our society, and that sports environments could be a place where discrimination, a place where prejudicial attitudes can be actively combated, seems very real to me. That seems very real and very possible.
We just have about 60 seconds left, and obviously you wrote your book One Game at a Time to speak to people. Do you think you have the ear, though, of the people that matter, the people that are? I mean, we're one of the stations that we're broadcasting to is a sports station, so you do have their ear. Are you hopeful you'll get a hearing?
It's been fantastic so far. You know, I'm trying to speak on multiple levels. I want to speak to sports fans and to athletes like me, people who really care about sports, and I want to say, hey, like, let's, you know, I want to talk to us and say, like, I think we can make a case for sports really mattering. But I also want to speak to people who loathe sports, who think that sports are full of kind of barbarians, and to say, hey, you know, hang on to your critical attitudes for sure. We need that. But But also I want you to pay some care and respect to the possibilities, to what I think of are the radical possibilities and the, you know, the radically political possibilities of sports. And the people who have, you know, kind of been generally ambivalent or disinterested and kind of befuddled by the sports world, I wanted to just say, hey, you know, I can't ask you to like sports. That's an aesthetic choice, but look to what all these people are thinking and caring about so much and talking about, and just consider the possibility that there's something really interesting going on there, just beyond just kind of vapid consumptivism. There's a ton of possibility in the sporting world that I think we condescend to at our peril.
All right, well, thank you so much for being on the show. The book is One Game at a Time, Why Sports Matter, by Matt Hearn, my guest. And you can go to mightymatthearn.com, also my website, peterwerby.com. Matt, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call. Now, more Riff Rock. 101 WRIF, everything that rocks.
I'm so happy, 'cause today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, 'cause so are you. Look on ears, Sunday morning is every day for all I care. And I'm not scared, light my candles in our days, 'cause I found God.